Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, September 30th, 2019. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you are listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389-POUND. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. And also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. We're reading in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 4. So we'll pick up there. Gospel of Mark, chapter 4, verses 35 through 41. And the same day, when the even was come, he, Lord Jesus, said unto them, Let us pass over unto the other side. And when they had sent away the multitude, they took him even as he was in the ship. And there were also with him other little ships. And there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship, so that it was now full. And he was in the hinder part of the ship asleep on a pillow. And they awake him, and say unto him, Master, carest thou not that we perish? And he rose and rebuked the wind, and said unto the sea, Peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said unto them, Why are ye so fearful? How is it that ye have no faith? And they feared exceedingly, and said one to another, What manner of man is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? Gospel of Mark, chapter 4, verses 35 through 41. Okay, Jan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Right. Have we had any luck at all trying to find another platform for our conference calling?
Nope, we have not.
Nothing. I can't believe that they call this their HD. I mean, the other one program that they shut down was so far superior. And
right.
This is really horrible, but I don't know. All right, if anybody out there is aware of any good conference calling program that we can move over to, please let us know. Okay, meanwhile, let's just get moving on. Okay, tonight we're going to look at the Republic, democracy versus Republic. And this is really a huge problem because we're not a democracy. And so we wrote a paper. We did file it with the court. Well, it didn't get filed yet. It went into the mail today, so it should be there probably the day after tomorrow. How are we doing on others sending those copies out to the 94 federal districts and others? Jan, did you get word out to those people yet?
All of the filings up to this last one have been covered. This last one I'm still working on. I can still use some volunteers for this last one.
Okay. So anybody would like to volunteer to assist us in some mailings? I think this one's a 5-pager, wasn't it? Yeah, I think it's 5 pages.
Right, it's just 5 pages, yeah.
Right, and so it's probably just one stamp. It could be a stamp and a half. I think it's 70 cents if it goes into that over that first ounce. But anyway, that's about the cost of it. Let's say 70 cents plus an envelope and 5 pages, printed out. And anybody that wants to volunteer to send some out, we're sending them out to 94 federal district courts and numerous others, I believe, the governors and some others. All of the ones that need to be registered, I've already sent them out. I sent them out today. They went out to the judiciary committees of the House and of the Senate. They went to the United States Supreme Court. They went to Attorney General Barr, also sent a copy to the President, Trump, and then a few other places that we've sent it to. We sent a copy to We the People, Robert Schultz, which we've been sending him and some others, you know, all of the copies that we've been doing. And so we filed quite a few papers so far. If anybody would like to go, well, everyone should get up there and read. This is an education. You know, the purpose of these papers that we're filing is, you know, first of all, we're at a decision time. Every paper we're filing from this point forward is just a decision of the court. And we have filed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 decisions so far of the court. The first paper filing for the decision was 50 pages. Everything else after that is less than 8 pages, 9 pages at the most. I didn't think we had any that many, but basically 5, 6, 7 pages. And they're all important papers. We also are filing an indictment, so anytime we need to file indictments, we're doing that also. And for those who haven't been following along or anybody that's new, we have been in court for over two years. We've been filing papers to all of these people for over 3 years, but we did file it under the auspices of the court up in the Northern District of New York for 2 years. They have not answered any paper we sent in. They've tried closing us down numerous times, and so far they have failed to do that. And they threatened to shut us down again. I don't remember exactly. I don't even know if I posted that letter from the judge, but I think we're past his 30-day mark again, aren't we? I'll have to take a look at that. Maybe we'll have that answer next week if nobody's got that tonight. But anyway, I don't think the judge is going to go remove papers. I think that'd be really too dangerous for this guy, even though he's been indicted twice. He has to get the clerk to do it. And, you know, and I don't think the clerk wants to do that anymore either. So we're kind of in a good situation. But look, even if they stop taking our papers, even if they were to return them, it doesn't matter. We move on. They're being filed everywhere. There may be about 200 different places we're filing all together, roughly. I know I file 10 different places, and then we have, again, many other people hopefully working to get these papers going for us, at least this upcoming one. But it's all about really putting the pressure on, telling the truth, getting the truth out there, getting more and more people to see that truth. And of course, part of this also, or a major part of this, is education. Not only for the individuals we're filing against, you know, the United States Supreme Court. I'm blown away by the attitude of the United States Supreme Court. I really am. They are a real contradiction. But hopefully we're going to see what's happening soon with them and what they're going to do. But again, we're educating them in the law. We're educating them in history, in our heritage, who we are, where we came from. And it's not just for educating them, it's for educating the people too. Every person that belongs to National Liberty Alliance, every member that we have, anybody that is active or even just semi-active, really should be reading these papers to become educated. If the people expect to be ignorant and free, as Jefferson said, you know, forget about it. It's not going to happen. So education is the key. If you don't understand really what your heritage is and what we've really lost, and you can't recognize the fact of what we have lost, I think next week it's going to become really quite clear in the paper we're going to be putting out. And I don't necessarily know. Well, I may turn it into a paper. It is it's a paper that I wrote for the sole purpose of really laying out National Liberty Alliance's plan in a nutshell. And I think it's going to be probably about 30 minutes long. I'm really trying to keep it as short as possible. But it's probably going to be about 30 minutes long. We'll put it on our front page as soon as we have it. And we may read that next week. And it's an extremely important paper. I've been working on it for a while. And it really explained very specifically and you know, focused on exactly where we are, how we got here, in a sense of how what the Congress has done in collusion with the judiciary, the United States Supreme Court, and all the federal judiciary, and how they colluded to really destroy our heritage, to destroy our law, to destroy our republic, to make people think we're a democracy and not a republic. And tonight we're going to hear a little bit of what our founding fathers had to say about a republic, a democracy and a republic. The Federalist Papers, if you really want to understand the Constitution, the Federalist Papers is really an important two papers. There's the Anti-Federalist and the Federalist Papers. Very, very powerful papers. A real good read. Maybe it may be true that people need to get some, understanding of certain things, and I think the papers that we've been doing will help to do that, to give them a better understanding of the Federalist Papers. Right now, I look to the Federalist Papers really to run keywords, to take a look at it, to support anything it is that we're writing or doing, but it really explains a lot about our Constitution, the meaning of the words in our Constitution, and who we are as a people, what they intended to accomplish, and they did accomplish it, and the people simply don't know. I don't think that even a lot of people who understand that we're a republic don't really understand how important it really is to get us away from that word democracy. And so we're going to read this paper. It's only about 15 minutes long. I filed this paper up on our website. So if anybody would like to follow along on it, just go to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, and click on highlight grand jury, and then click on the action against the judiciary. Okay. And you will find our papers there. 1, 2, 3, 4. This is the sixth paper. We have been filing one paper every week. Let's see. The first one we filed was on the 17th. The second one was on that was August 17th. Then September 3rd, September 9th, September 16th, September 25th, and now September 30th. So it's about every 7 days we've been filing a paper. We want to continue to do that. For numerous reasons. Again, we're doing small papers, only a few pages at a time, 5, 6, 7 pages. So it's easily digestible, not only for the people we're writing to, but also for anybody reading in on it. Again, these papers in themselves is a really huge, huge education. They're eye-openers. They really explain the problems and also gives the solution. And at the end of every paper, we give an order. And there's an order that flows through this whole thing. It's very simple, and we can probably just live with just that one order. And we do with that one order, but we usually make some other points in our orders. But it's really simple, and it's this. Obey the law. Doesn't get any more difficult than that. These people are under the Constitution, and they ignore it. I understand exactly how they think that they can get away with this, how they think that they are protected in some way, shape, or form. And hopefully over time, as we keep filing these papers, that will become clearer and clearer. I don't know exactly what – I've got a couple papers I'm working on, and there's one paper I've been thinking about, which is probably the one I'm going to try to do, which really is a paper to make the point to these people. You think they want to ignore us? They can ignore us, but there's going to be a consequence for that. And at some point in time, they're not going to be able to ignore us. We are the people. We have a constitution. We have unalienable rights to do everything we're doing, and everything we're doing is supported by history, by the founding papers of our nation alone supports everything that we're doing in this particular court case. Many statements, quotes from our founding fathers, again, supports everything that we're doing in this paper. We are doing and going forward on the right road, the right process to accomplish the goal we expect to accomplish. And again, I think the main reason why they're not really responding properly yet is because they think that they're still under the protection of the deep state. They didn't get the memo yet. Deep state is on its way out. It's only a matter of time. And again, you know, I say this quite often on Monday nights. I suggest to people, and I suggest to people that they should you know, try to keep up to date on what's happening by listening to X-22 report. In my opinion, it is the most powerful, most, you know, really focused and in-depth reporting of exactly what is going on behind the scenes. And if anybody isn't aware of where to find them, well, you can just go to YouTube and put an X-22 report. You'll find it that way. Or you can go up to our page on National Liberty Alliance, and I believe it's under news. No, actually, I think I put it under Q. I think that's where you'll find different places that we suggest people might go to get the latest news. We've got some good video in there that really kind of brings people up to par. But then at the bottom of these videos, we have a link to the X-22 report. We also have the Black Conservative Patriot, another excellent, excellent sources. Of all of them, I think between those two, they're some of the best. But those two particularly, and again, there are others. We have Greg Hunter up there, SGT Report, and Truth and Art TV, You Are Free TV. So if people have more time, they can listen to more news. But if if your time is really tight and you don't have a lot of time, I would say definitely first and foremost, X-22 Report is the one you want to listen to for the day. And usually they're between anywhere from 25 minutes to maybe 45 minutes. But in-depth and really a great, great insight on, you know, where we're at, what we're doing. Anyway, these papers, again, people should be reading them carefully. I suggest if you really want to really have this sink in, my suggestion is to read the paper straight out and then come back and read it again carefully with the footnotes, you know, going back to see the footnotes for a further explanation. And, of course, we have sources of everything we write. That's all found in footnotes. And so, again, you know, we need to become educated. We need to understand what the problem is. We need to understand how we got here. We need to understand what is in their mind. I mean, they are just, it's a fiction, and they're resting on nothing, absolutely nothing. And as soon as the floor is pulled out from underneath them, so to speak, you know, with what Trump is doing, and they're exposed to the crimes that they're committing, and they start to fall apart there, I believe that's when we're going to get our best, you know, move forward on what we're doing. You know, the people are going to, you know, it's going to be have a lot more weight. They're going to have a lot more fear about what they're doing and how they're doing, how they're responding to our papers and so on. But again, education is the key. You know, you cannot accomplish, you know, the saving of America, the saving our republic without understanding what our republic is, what our heritage is, what liberty truly is, what is law. And that's a real eye-opener. Let me tell you, what is law? That's an eye-opener. Okay, so tonight we're going to be looking at, we're going to be reading through a paper. It's labeled in the front of the paper, Democracy versus Republic. It is a paper we filed. And again, if you want to follow along with a copy, highlight grand jury, click on action against judiciary, and it is the one on the bottom, dated September 30th, 2019, and it's written up as writ mandamus and an information concerning the republic. This is a writ mandamus and information directed to the United States Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, and both houses of Congress concerning democracy versus the republic. Article 4, Section 4. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion. While trying to discover a form of government, John Adams wrote that democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There was never a democracy that did not commit suicide. Our founding fathers reviled democracy and gave their posterity a republic. As Thomas Jefferson said, the republican is the only form of government which is not eternally at open or secret war with the rights of mankind. Edmund Burke said, "Of this I am certain, that in a democracy the majority of the citizens is capable of exercising the most cruel oppression upon the minority." Thomas Jefferson, "A democracy is nothing more than mob rule, where 51% of the people may take away the rights of the other 49%. Benjamin Franklin, "Democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch. Liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote." Winston Churchill, "The best argument against democracy is a five-minute conversation with the average voter." Aristotle, "Unlimited democracy is just like an oligarchy, a tyranny spread over a large number of people." In Federalist Papers No. 1, we read, "The necessity of a government at least equally energetic with the one proposed to the attainment of this object, the conformity of the proposed Constitution to the true principles of a republican government in its equivalence to our state constitutions." Federal No. 10, "Democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been at short in their lives as they were have been violent in their deaths." Anti-Federalist Paper No. 10, "True Democrats are in general fanatics and enthusiasts, and some few sensible, charming madmen." Anti-Federalist No. 18 through 20, "A confederacy of republics must be the establishment in America, or we must cease altogether to retain the republican form of government. From the moment we became one great republic, either in form or substance, the period is very shortly removed when we shall sink first into monarchy and then into despotism. Before we establish a government whose acts will be the supreme law of the land and whose powers will extend to almost every case without exception, we ought carefully to guard ourselves by a Bill of Rights against the invasion of those liberties which it is essential for us to retain, which it is of no real use for government to deprive us of, but which in the course of human events have been too often insulted with the wantonness of an idle barbatry." Federalist Paper No. 48, "In a democracy where a multitude of people exercise in person the legislative functions and are continually exposed by their incapacity for regular deliberation and concerted measures to the ambitious intrigues of their executive magistrates, tyranny may very well be apprehended on some favorable emergency to start up in the same quarter." Anti-Federalist Paper No. 74, "There is not a tincture of democracy in the proposed Constitution except the nominal elections. Every free man of America ought to hold up this idea to himself, that he has no superior but God and the laws, an indication that something has been present." Auberon Hubert, a 19th century British politician and writer, described democracy like this: "Five men are in a room. Because three men take one view and two another, have the three men any moral right to enforce their views on the other two men? What magical powers come over the three men that because they are one more than in number than the other two men, therefore they suddenly become possessors of the minds and the bodies of these others? As long as they were two to two, so long we supposed each man remained master of his own mind and body. But from the moment that another man, acting, heaven only knows from what motives, has joined himself to one party or to the other, that party has become straightway possessed of the souls and of the bodies of the other party. Was there ever such a degrading and indefensible superstition? Is it not the true lineal descendant of the old superstitions about emperors and high priests and their authority over the souls and bodies of men? We constantly hear congressmen, senators, presidents, and even United States Supreme Court justices refer to America as a democracy. Are our elected servants that ignorant of our Constitution, our history, and our heritage? Or is it their methodical, covert conspiracy hell-bent on destroying our republic? Just how close are we? Or should I say, how close were we? I think the following says it all. When President Barack Obama, during the 2016 White House Correspondents' Dinner, where he predicted Hillary Clinton's presidency in 2017, said, "The end of the republic has never looked better." And then the unexpected happened. By God's mercy and divine providence, the coup failed, and President Trump was elected in her stead and declared, in contrast, "In America, the people govern, the people rule, the people are sovereign. I was elected not to take power, but to give power to the American people where it belongs." Elected and appointed servants are creatures of the law, also known as the United States Constitution. Whereas we the people, as sovereigns, and subservient to the laws of nature's God alone, not civil law, not equity, we the people ordained and established the Constitution for the United States of America, and thereby vesting a clipped sovereignty to Congress under Article 1, the President under Article 2, and the Supreme Court under Article 3. This is the supreme law of the land. Article 6, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all the treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding." The preamble, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." As a consequence, we the people are above the Constitution, whereas the aforesaid three branches of government are bound under the Constitution and thereby restricted or clipped in authority and jurisdictions. We have not vested Congress with the authority to legislate our behavior. All legislative states, statutes, codes, and regulations implemented in equity courts are for elected, appointed, and hired government servants alone and commercial activities. Black's Law Dictionary defines a democracy as that form of government in which the sovereign power resides in and is exercised by the whole body of free citizens, as distinguished from a monarchy or aristocracy or an oligarchy. According to the theory of a pure democracy, every citizen should participate directly in the business of governing, and the legislative assembly should comprise the whole people. Of course, this is not possible, and if it were without a constitution, this would be mob rule. Representative democracy, being a government liberated from a constitution, would place we the people under the thumb of the legislators, the judiciary, and the administrations that would then have the power to give or take the people's rights at will. Such a government would not be able to sustain three separate and equal branches. One would eventually subdue the others. Nor would a democracy permit a government by consent of the people. A representative democracy will always become an oligarchy, which is a small group of people having the control of the country behind what appears to be a democracy. Not unlike the deep state in the United States today, because we the people, being ignorant of our heritage and having been told for more than 100 years by our servant governments who have become our masters, that we are a democracy, and the populace believe. With the introduction of representative democracy, which is a form of government where the powers of the sovereignty are delegated to a body of men elected from time to time, who exercise them for the benefit of the whole nation. With such a democracy, unshackled by law, that is, the Constitution, the results would be absolute tyranny. They already ignore our Constitution, and in this case, and our efforts over the past 20 years prove it. But the times, they are changing. There is a new chief in town. The swamp is being drained, the people are rising, and the resisters of the law will be tried in courts of law for treason. In a republic, a constitution or a charter of rights protects certain unalienable rights that cannot be taken away by the government, even if it has been elected by a majority of voters. In a democracy, the majority is not restrained in this way and can impose its will on a minority. Although we choose most of our representatives and our local heads of states and judges democratically, they are all governed by the law of the land, which restricts their powers and jurisdiction in order to conform to the will of the people through the Constitution by authority vested in the people via natural law. To highlight the offensiveness to liberty that democracy and majority rule is, just ask yourself, how many decisions in your life would you like to be made democratically? How about what kind of a car you can drive? Where you live, whom you marry, whether you have a turkey or ham for Thanksgiving dinner. If those decisions were made through a democratic process, the average person would see it as tyranny and not personal liberty. Isn't it no less tyranny for the democratic process to determine what is lawful and what is not lawful? Whether you purchase health insurance or set aside money for retirement? But for ourselves and our fellow man around the globe, we should be advocating liberty, not the democracy that we've become. When an unscrupulous Congress does anything upon which they can muster a majority vote. In 2016, we stood at the precipice. Today, we stand at the doors of justice. Silence can only be equated with fraud, where there is a legal or moral duty to speak, or where an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading. Audit. Congressmen, senators, judges, and all appointed and employed bureaucrats are commanded to honor their oath to guarantee a Republican form of government, and stop trying to convince the average voter that we are a democracy. The New World Order is DOA, dead on arrival. Dated September 30th, 2019, Albany, New York. Signed, Grand Jury Foreman. Okay. One other point I'd like to make, and that goes back to the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers, the original Federalist Papers, you know, that came out, I believe it was in 1787, when they finished their conversations and prepared a constitution. But it was a little later with a debate that the Anti-Federalists picked up on. And the difference between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists mainly is that the Federalists generally wanted bigger federal government, where the Anti-Federalists, they wanted a federal government too, of course, set up, and of course the structure that we've set it up, but they wanted to make sure that their powers were very limited. And the real conclusion or solution that the Anti-Federalists came up with, the Constitution was signed in 1789, but the fruits of the labor of the Anti-Federalists really didn't get picked up until 1791, I believe it was, and that was through the Bill of Rights. That was the fruit of their labor. Although when we read through the Constitution, we can kind of see there are a few places, particularly in Article 1, Section 9 and 10, I think it's in 10 mostly if I recall, where there are some statements that really focus in on our unalienable rights that seem, I think, was really squeezed in there by the Anti-Federalist agreeing with the Federalist some changes in the Constitution. But they did refuse to sign, many of the states refused to sign that Constitution without a Bill of Rights. But they did sign it without a Bill of Rights as long under the promise that a Bill of Rights would be added, and they had already framed out, I believe it was 12 rights. And if I recall going through them, really all 12 are pretty much there, it's just that they were boiled down to 10. But a couple of things I think really was the fruit of the Anti-Federalist is, for instance, in its article, Section 9, Article 1, Section 9, not Section 10. But it's in that section where it talks, for instance, the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in the cases of a rebellion or invasion, the privacy of the public safety may require it. Okay, so only if the public safety requires it in a rebellion. But even if there is a rebellion or some kind of an invasion, as long as we can continue to go forward, you know, in different areas, there's no reason why writ of habeas corpus should be, you know, suspended, only under the strongest of emergencies. another couple of things, and again, the whole thing on the Anti-Federalist is really a masterpiece, and that was really put together by Madison and Jefferson, who worked quite closely together in numerous things. They agreed on a lot of things. They both were very, very heavily educated in the history. They both spoke many, many languages, and they studied history. For instance, they studied the Bible, the Old Testament, particularly looking back to Israel back in the days of Moses. But they both went and learned Hebrew in order to study in their original tongue. That's how committed they were. To really dig down, because that's our government is structured according to the nation of Israel. And that's why some people refer to the United States of America as an Israel or a second Israel, because we have the very same form of government. We're also the second nation, recorded nation, known that has picked up the law under God and not under man. Now, we know that the Anglo-Saxons, coming down from the north, the Germanic tribes, that they had carried that down with them also into Britain. And the common law of Britain is really structured behind all of that. And Jefferson was very surprised to find out that they were living and exercising their way of government and controlling their government the very same way that the Israelis did. Back at about 1600 B.C. So anyway, it was Madison and Jefferson particularly who really framed out most of the Bill of Rights. Jefferson was out of the country at the time and communicated with Madison, and Madison brought forth most of what we see in the Bill of Rights. I mean, in the Federalist Papers, which would be the Anti-Federalist Papers. And the whole idea was to neutralize any problems that could arise out of a misunderstanding of the Constitution. As a matter of fact, let me see if I can find this quickly. It is worded exactly that way. Let me read this. Congress of the United States, this is the preamble to the Bill of Rights. It says here, the convention of the number of the states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, expressed the desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. You see, the restricted cause is the key. You know, you can't do this, you can't do that, don't do this, don't do that. You know, which is pretty much what the Bill of Rights is. For instance, Congress shall make no law respecting an established of religion or forbidding the free exercise thereof. Okay, so going back to this preamble, a desire in order to prevent the misconstruction or abuse of its powers that further declaratory or and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the grounds of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution and resolved by the Senate and the House and so on. Okay, so the Bill of Rights is key. When we read any law, we read the Constitution, the federal Constitution, or the Constitution of any state, anything that is repugnant to those rights, that Bill of Rights, is null and void. And so we read the Constitution, all law, and all constitutions in light of the Bill of Rights. And that's a very important point that people really need to understand. Because if someone is misinterpreting something, all you have to do is see if it violates one of our unalienable rights. And it doesn't have to necessarily be just the Ten Amendments that describes these rights. Our rights go far further than the Ten Amendments. But these are our basic fundamental rights. These fundamental rights were picked up in the Declaration of Independence. Let me just read something out of that real quick, maybe a paragraph. Just read a paragraph out of this, or two. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal stations to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the cause which impels them to the separation. There is the foundation of our law. Right there, the laws of nature and of nature's God and what it entitles us to, you know, the blessings, the benefit, the liberties that we get from living under the law of God. And of course, there is no greater law to live under than the law of God, because the law of man will always, you know, bring you into slavery over and over and over again. History is just filled with that constant end results. Another paragraph, the second paragraph after that, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and that is the key of common law, self-evident truths. You know, and again, you know, we look the rules of common law, when it's referred to the rules of common law, it's referring really to the self-evident truths. That's what it's referring to. And for instance, for every injury, there must be a remedy. Who can disagree with that? Nobody can disagree with that. In order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party. Who can disagree with that? These are maxims. This is what governs us. This is what governs. It's truths that cannot be denied. It's self-evident truths, as Jefferson penned it here in the Declaration of Independence. So we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Who can argue with that? That they are endowed by their Creator. Who can argue with that? With certain unalienable rights, being a child of God, be born of man, by God, created by God, we have certain unalienable rights. We receive these blessings only by the blessings of God, which we're going to look about a little bit in the preamble of the Constitution. But with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life. Who can argue that we everyone has a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Who can argue with that? That is a righteous government, a government that is controlled by the people ultimately. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. The purpose of government is to protect the people, to protect our unalienable rights. And until we bring our government back to that principle and to act and all their deeds be back under that principle, We're never going to have liberty completely. Only until we can bring that back under the change of the Constitution can we have that. So just one more paragraph I want to read, and this one's out of the Constitution itself. It's the preamble to the Constitution. And it says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. Okay, prior to that, the union was not a perfect union. A lot of problems with the Confederacy. It wasn't until the Constitution was finally adopted, agreed upon, and the president was elected, and this nation began, had its birth. Until then, this was the more perfect union. And it's pretty darn perfect, when you look at the way this whole thing was structured. So to form a more perfect union, establish justice. That's the purpose of government. We the people ordained this for this purpose, and to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare, and to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. And that's a very important sentence here that people really need to meditate a little bit on. The purpose of government is to secure the blessings of liberty. Liberty is not something that we just get here or there. We're blessed with it. If God does not bless us with that liberty, we're not going to have it. And the only way we're going to be blessed with his liberty is to live under his law. And so our courts of law must be courts of law, not courts of men, not civil courts, not equity courts. Courts of law. The word law, and this runs throughout all of everything I've read and all of the books, Black's Law. You go back and you read all these things, particularly you go into the dictionary, Black's Law Dictionary, and you start looking up the meaning of law. And they're very, 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 very specific about this, even though it gets a little confusing because statutes are called law, but it's a certain kind of law. Codes are called law, but it's a certain kind of law. Civil law is a certain kind of law. But the word law, standing on itself, in law, at law, is natural law. And it is clear when you go back and you very carefully read through these things, it becomes clear. Equity is called positive law. You know, when I first realized that, I thought that this was a game of words that they had used or because they've taken equity to try to annihilate our law. But not so. Proper law and equity, which is law, it's called positive law, but it's law through an authority. And the authority has to be a real authority. And to trace the authority, you have to trace it back to God. So the authority comes from God to the people, to the Constitution, and to those who are to be obedient to that law, the equity law. So it's what we wrote. And it's also written a lot of it with self-evident truths. But it's all about controlling our government. The laws are written there to control them, not us, to maintain, make sure they stay in line, that they don't come outside of their jurisdiction, that they don't injure people, and to make sure that certain things, they're held accountable to. Okay? That's what equity is about. We go to court. We don't go to court in equity. We go to court in law. And in a court of law, the people rule. Not a judge, no political animal is to rule in that court. They are to keep silent. The only one that is to echo the will of the jury, which is the people, the only one to echo that will is the magistrate of the court, which is an administrator. He's only to administrate the will of the court, of the tribunal, which in a court of law is a jury. So, when we look at these things in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and we see the harmony, the Declaration of Independence is the foundation of our law. It's built upon laws, God's law. That's what the Declaration, declares. The laws of nature and of nature's God. That's what we as a people are built upon. And the Constitution is the framework of our law to control our government and the authority we gave them to control all of the different agencies and all of the actions of government and all commercial activities and a few other key points that we've given them authority, like bankruptcy, writing laws on bankruptcy, and a few other things. But the capstone, okay, is liberty. The capstone is the Bill of Rights. The capstone is restrictive clauses telling them not to violate this right, not to violate that right. We have these unalienable rights, you know. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or forbidding the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people to peacefully or to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. And we have been trying to, petition the government for redress of grievances very specifically and in a very thoughtful and lawful and historical way over the past 20 years, very specifically starting off with the work that Robert Schultz had done with, through We the People organization. That was one of the first things he brought in to get going was to petition the government for redress of grievances. They decided not to hear. And we asked them the question, are we still under the Bill of Rights? Do we still have a Constitution? And they met us with silence. This has gone on for 20 years. So we've been in the courtroom, really, for 20 years. Doesn't matter that you weren't in a court in a literal fashion. All the papers were properly filed. They broke the law, removing many papers, denying them, ignoring them. And when we started picking up here at National Liberty Alliance, filing papers 3-4 years ago, again, they ignored them. And we got them into a place where we'd be under the auspices of the court. They continue to ignore them, meet us with silence. It's all fraud. Case is over. We are now making decisions. And that's what it's all about here at this point, making orders and decisions. And in that process, also, teaching people through the writing of these papers as well as these people who are supposed to be our servants, who think they're our masters. But this will have power. This will go forward, and this will be successful at some point in time. And again, it's going to require two things, okay? It's going to require, really, a mass of people to move forward on this thing. We need to hit that point of critical mass. And I see us approaching very, very slowly, but I see us approaching it. And the other thing is really that not only hitting a critical mass, but for the deep state to be going down, because then panic will start to take place. A lot of people will remove themselves or be removed from government. There will be a great power vacuum because the control of the courts have been literally by the judiciary, okay? The judiciary has been controlling the courts, the will of the judges, and they have been maintaining status quo of the elite. And once that is disconnected, it's a free fall. No one is controlling that anymore. That's where we the people have to be there to catch and control that, because that's how we consent the government, one of the two ways that we consent the government. And, of course, there's a lot of little ways we do also, but the two major ways is controlling the judiciary and controlling the political realm. And, again, we're going to be picking up on this in the next month or two. We're going to be talking more also about the committeeman process and how we take control of the political process. And the PowerPoint video that I'm putting together, I hope to have it done this week. It's pretty well done. I'm really just starting to go through putting it together, but all the writing's been pretty much done on that. That's going to cover also how to take back not only the judicial power and authority, taking our courts back, but also how to take back our political process. And we're going to try to start encouraging people in every state here, in every county, to start running for committeemen. But we'll start pushing that probably in a couple of weeks. We're coming into October. I'd like to say by November we should be heavily into talking about taking control of the political process. And it's not. This is not a rocket scientist either. This is a very, very simple thing to do. But people need to do it right. And if you do it right and you get elected properly, you can take control. But again, we'll lay that aside. We're going to deal with that probably next month. We're going to start talking. But it will be in NLA's plan in a nutshell, I think we may call this video, which will be about 30 minutes, I think. And it's going to explain how we got here, what we've done, where we are in the court, how we're going to take back the judicial process, and also very detailed points on how we're going to take back the political process. But it's up to the people to respond to it. It's up to us to get the message out. But the people have to do this. Only the people can save the republic. So, okay, let me see what else we got. Do we have any announcements, Jan?
No, we just have, I guess we should say we have two. The Welcome Committee is down to bare minimum. Again, we could use some help there, calling people, and with our continuous mailings each week, we could use one or two more people that are willing to send out, 20 or 30 envelopes. That would be great. Other than that, I think we're in pretty good shape.
Okay. How about any questions?
We have questions.
Okay.
Ready for questions?
I'm ready for questions.
Okay. And I have to listen carefully to this first one because of the way it's written. James has advised me to inquire with you about the joinder procedure because my wife has changed her name legally from Leela to Paula. However, on our tax court case, her older name is reflected. On the intake form and our check, which we wish to send to you, has her new updated name and my given birth name, which is not exactly the same as on the intake form or the tax court case, yet legal, and we are asking if any changes need to be made. Also, can I send the payment by Priority Express since our trial is scheduled for mid-November and our time is limited?
Okay, well, a couple of things. Let's deal with the tail end of that point first. Once we get the paperwork going, James will start moving on the papers. I mean, as soon as he gets the joinder paper out for signature, we prepare it correctly and you get it goes out for signature, and you drop it in the mail. Within 2 days, as long as Jim's caught up, within 2 days, those papers will go out and we'll move along. But it's going to take time. You know, the amicus curiae, which is what we're doing, the first point and part of that, the major point of that is challenging the jurisdiction and talking about jurisdictions unknown and the denial of due process, we have to give them 30 days to respond. Now, you know, this is where these papers that we've been filing, not only in the Northern District Court and with all of the players involved in as far as being defendants, but also getting a copy out to these federal district courts and other places plays an important role because it gets the word out of what we're doing. I'm trying to frame a paper. And if I can get it done, you know, it really should shake them up a little bit, lay out the powers and the authority of the people, make it clear what our intentions are, and that we're going to be asked at the end of the day, all those found still in resistance, because they have time to, you know, kind of repent and turn away and start working with the people and supporting the Constitution and our liberties and start doing the right thing. But over time, that olive branch that we're offering them is going to eventually fall away. And at the end of the day, whoever's found in resistance at that point, we are seeking to go after them, simple word we use all the time. Let me see if I can find a note on this. Well, in any event, we're going to be going after them, you know, really for denying our unalienable rights, for subversion, and it's a better word than subversion, but subversion against the Constitution, subversion against the people, okay? And in that process, we're going to ask for the ultimate penalty. But we're giving them plenty of time. You know, we still got lots of papers to be continue to file. There's still some time before we hit that critical mass. There's still some time before the deep state finally collapses. I mean, it's close to it, but it's got to collapse, and collapse means that people are going to start to go to jail. And at that point in time, you know, when the clock runs out, we're going to seek the maximum. Because what they have done was really to destroy our law, to destroy our Constitution, to deny our unalienable rights, to deny the people's Constitution, plainly and simply. And they did this by rule, by the way. And I think in this paper we're going to make that point, that they've done it by rule. Not even by, you know, making some fake law up and sticking it up there, which they're pretty good at and they've been doing. But they actually did it by rule. I guess Congress was just a little too frightened to go that far with what they had done with Rule 2. But they made it very obscure, very hard to see. What I was trying to think of, and I don't know why I couldn't think of it, was treason. Just couldn't, fell away from my lips here. But in any event, treason is what we're going after them for. And the maximum penalty for that. Just think of all the lives that have been destroyed by these evil courts, all the people that have lost their lives in jail, suffered many, many years in jail, all the patriots. Think of what they did with the Bundys and what they did with Lavoie Finnegan and the Hammonds and many, many, many other people. And that poor guy, that elderly guy that was just digging a hole in his property for a pond and what they did to him. Diesel therapy, for anybody that knows who doesn't know what diesel therapy is they arrest you, put you in a vehicle, and you go for months in a vehicle. They'll take you to one destination, move you into another vehicle, and roll you around again for some other time, put you in another vehicle and move you around. They keep moving you around. It's called diesel therapy. And it's, you know, it's very destructive, especially on someone that's elderly. And I understand that they, you know, did diesel therapy with this one individual. I don't remember. I think his name was Robinson or something. He was up there in Montana, I believe it was. Let me see.
Right.
Yeah, I think Montana.
Joe Robinson.
Robinson, thank you. So, you know, all the people that they have destroyed, all of the rights, look at all the suffering, okay? I mean, look at the people in our county jails. You know, 90% and more. You know, Judge Bork says it was 90%. I think it's more. I think he was being, you know, a little off on his numbers, but 90% of the people, and I think more, that are in jail in our county jails don't belong there. They're there unlawfully. And as a matter of fact, I think it's more than that, in my opinion. You know, when you go up against the state, when the state comes out after you, they don't put you in county jail. They put you in a state prison. And the federal government has federal prisons. Okay, and all those people, just think of how many of those people are just there and going to court in jurisdictions unknown. I mean, there hasn't been a court of record that I'm aware of that's really been, you know, accepted and seen as a court of record probably in my lifetime. You know, when you have a jury that's tainted and told that they were under civil law and that they have to run their decision in the way that they say the law is, you know, they get to interpret it, and these people are put in jail when many times when they look at the facts and the stories, the jury might go one way, but because the judge says, if this happened or that happened, you got to find them guilty, okay? And so this happened and that happened, but it didn't matter because that wasn't unlawful what the people do by rejecting and denying. I mean, take IRS itself. You know, how many people are in jail, and they seem to like to give 6 years. 6 years seems to be like the general penalty that they love to give out. But just think about that. You're going into a courtroom that's not a courtroom. It's a tax court. It's a hired court. Okay, it's not even, and it's run by, you know, the judges in that courtroom are real judges, but they're hired out. It's like moonlighting. Okay, so they have the special room they rent out. They hire a judge to put him in there, and he's a real judge from the real, you know, the federal district courts. And they're coming and operating with the cloak of law under the color of law. They're coming with the cloak of law, the cover of law, the color of law, and claiming it to be true, and it's not. USC 26 has no jurisdiction. It says nothing about jurisdiction anywhere. It says it within itself that it's not even law, and no construction is to be considered of this in U.S. 26 as a construction in law. And it denies the whole idea, which is direct taxes, is denied in the Constitution in numerous places. Okay, direct taxes are not lawful. And yeah, and absolutely, you know, even the fact that even if it was lawful to go to jail for because you have a bill and you don't pay it, we America never got lost in that. I know that was a problem in England. They had debtors' prisons, but we did not. We do not have debtors' prisons here in the United States. Well, what do you think these tax courts are all about? About putting people into debtors' prison? And yet, you know, think of all the suffering, all the damage, the destruction of lives, destruction of families, okay? These judges that don't turn and comply and don't bend to the will of the people before we get to that point of critical mass, they need to pay the ultimate penalty. And that's not enough to pay it, but it's in God's hand. In the end, the tally will be done right anyway, so it's really in God's hand anyway. But anyway, that's where we're going with that. And I'm hopefully the next paper is going to really focus in on this so that these people understand. But it may take longer than a week to write that paper. We'll see what happens. Okay. Anyway, I started answering the question. I don't know how I got lost on that. But there was a second. The main part of that question was something to do with the names. We're trying to figure out what name to use also or no?
Right. They had changed their names legally, I guess, and they... Tax court names were different than their new names.
Okay. Right, what I would do if I were them is I would, in their paperwork particularly, now let me think, probably in their affidavit, okay, they should make the point, try to bring that story down to minimum sentences. Maybe at most a paragraph, but just minimum sentences, you know, just keep massaging it to the point where it's clear that this is what your birth name was, and you also came under this name. You may not have to even get very specific on why the name changed. I mean, if you want to, fine. But basically, get a paragraph in there that talks about all these names, and then make the point at the end, here and after, whatever name you want to use at that point, which I would think would be the one that's most prominent in the court at the time. So really end up by using that name, I would think, unless for some reason you want to use a different name. But really just make a paragraph explaining it in the minimum amount of words but here and after you're going to be identified or known as whatever name it is you end up with. For confusion's sake, whatever name you're using in the court that were filing the amicus curiae, and you should really end up using that name, and this would, you know, take care of any of the confusion. But at least that one paragraph will really clarify anything, and that's the simplest way I can think of doing it. Okay, next question.
Okay, I have an issue with the State of Idaho Department of Finance suing me related to a failed business venture involving an Idaho investor. They are suing me for fraud, saying I violated the Securities Act. They are relying on a deposition from the investor that doesn't really say much, and a sworn affidavit from someone I don't know at all, presumably paid for by the state. Since I am an LLC accepted a benefit doing the business in their state, did I somehow grant them jurisdiction over myself personally? I'd like to joinder my case, and Jin said that I needed to find this out first. They aren't allowing me a trial by jury, and it looks like the judge is going to enter MJ or MSJ Monday.
Okay. I think a very, very short synopsis of the case I would like to look at, and we'll think about it. If they're coming out after you personally, and they're not coming out after you as a corporation but as a person, and it's the government that's coming out after you as a person, if that is the case, you know, just short and simple that way, then yeah, we could do a joinder. And the key thing to this whole thing is we're not agreeing with someone that they're innocent or even guilty. We're not making those decisions. That's not what we're doing. The whole system stinks. And the problem is that you're in jurisdictions unknown. And if they want to try to prosecute you for something, then they should be doing it properly in a court of law. And if they won't do it in a court of law, then they should do it in no court at all. And because that's what the Constitution requires, that's your unalienable right, to have access to a court of law. You know, the right that you have, you must be indicted by a jury of your peers. And then you must be convicted by a jury of your peers. And they have to believe that you're guilty of something, and it is up to them to decide what kind of a penalty might need to be paid. And again, in most cases, it should not be jail at all. I mean, jail is not the answer, the solution. It's not the way to solve a problem. It's not the way to bring, the injured party back into a restored condition. Nor is it a way to bring the person who did the injury back to a restored condition. Because the opportunity through a proper penalty ends up to be really repentance to some degree, or penance anyway. But, you know, it's the beginning of a repentance. Repentance has to go into the heart, but that opportunity is now there for that person to be brought back into society again and repair everybody. You know, that's what common law is all about, is fixing everybody, not just the injured party. Now, I do agree that there are certain situations where people need to go to jail, but certainly not a situation like this. I just don't see it. And again, I should hope that most people, once they get a little educated, won't see it either. And we will put together a very good, which we have a lot of it, we just haven't structured it yet. But we're going to put together a really good orientation program that'll really free the minds, the hearts, and the spirits of the people for the purpose of deciding under as a grand jurist or a trial jurist. But we have to be very careful on what we put together and what we introduce to them. We don't want to create bias from a different perspective. But people need to understand that they have to come with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy at the end of the day. They have to always consider mercy at the end of the day. But they're really looking to deal with the problem. So that's where we want to end up being with that. Read that question one more time to see if I missed anything.
The top to bottom?
Well, not all. Well, the last part of it anyway.
Okay. Well, he has the Idaho Department of Finance.
Oh.
Hey, Brent, go ahead and talk a little bit because we seem to have lost John.
Can you hear me now? Hello. I'll start talking, but it doesn't sound like anybody is able to signal me that I'm being heard.
You are being heard, and I don't know what happened to John and Jan. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I got dropped.
Okay. Well, Jen, if John's not on, I'll talk a little bit. Is that all right?
Yeah, go right ahead. I don't see him right now. I think he got dropped, too, at the same time I did.
All right. Well, let's talk about the Constitution of the United States, because we left off coming up on Article 2. I wasn't here last week. And we left off there the week before that. Going through the Constitution of the United States, clause by clause, blow by blow. And while I'm waiting, oh, it's, my pinwheel was spinning. Here we go. Section 10, Clause 3. Article 1, we're right at the end of Article 1, says, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with any other state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. This clause of our Constitution bars any of the several states from entering a confederation with any foreign power. And this phrase embraces everything from nations to religious hierarchies, such as the Vatican of Rome, which is now recognized as a sovereign, thanks to Ronald Reagan. Before that, we never recognized the Vatican as a sovereign. By the way, that has grand implications, because if anyone swears loyalty to the Vatican or the Pope, then that compromises loyalty to the United States, just as being a citizen or swearing loyalty to a foreign country, such as Ted Cruz, still does as a citizen of Canada. Utterly forbidden to run for president. Odd that nobody mentioned that. And not only him, but Jindal, and who was that other fellow that ran for president? He had the same problem. What, Obama had a similar problem, but there were three of them running as Republicans that had that problem. Well, this clause applies the Christian just war tradition. I want to repeat that phrase, Christian just war tradition, to the states. What is the just war tradition of the Christian, of the Christian faith of Christendom? This is well known among folk that spend their time studying such things. The just war tradition at bottom says this: we shouldn't go to war unless somebody's trying to invade us, unless somebody's trying to attack us. Unless somebody does attack us, or it's imminent that they're going to invade or attack. In other words, we shouldn't be calivating around the world attacking other people. That's unchristian. The whole Western world said that for centuries. They didn't practice it, don't get me wrong. But at least they had it in their understanding, and it was a handle that could have been used if they'd have done it. And we would probably do well to go back and rethink this a little bit. The just war tradition limits war powers to defense against aggressors, forbidding any state to keep regular troops or warships in peacetime, now watch this, without the consent of Congress. This clause says that if Congress consents, Texas or California, or Oregon or Washington, they can have their own Navy. If Congress consents. If Congress doesn't consent, they're not allowed to do that. I've been told that Texas, the state of Texas, still has a Navy. So they started out as a country, as you know, and they gained their independence, and they were a sovereign country, separate from the United States, and at that time they had their own army and they had their own Navy. And they truly did. But they don't now. There is an organization that's been formed, and it looks like the taxpayer's paying for it. It's called something about the Navy of Texas. And people in Texas actually believe that they have a Navy, but they don't. What they have is an organization that's dedicated to teaching the history of the Navy of Texas. But without Congress, the states are not to do that, not to have a Navy or a standing army. They do have a militia, though. Every state has a militia, whether they understand it or not, whether they use it or not, or whether they make provision for it or not, because the militia are the people. I'm quoting those that framed our nation. They said that in more ways than one, and more than one of them said it. The militia are the people, and the people are the militia. That's every able-bodied male. That's the militia. And when the Constitution of the United States says, we the people, that's the subset of men to which it refers, the people, the militia of the several states. And that follows the pattern of the Older Testament, because the word, the phrase, the people of the Older Testament, translates the Hebrew word ha'am, ha, with a definite article, the, and am is the word we translate people, and it means the militia, the armed, or able to bear arms, males, 20 years old and upward, according to the standard of God in the Older Testament, more so than any place else in the book of Numbers, some in the book of Deuteronomy, but the book of Numbers is the book about martial law, and that's why it's called Numbers, because they numbered the militia of the 12 separate tribes of Israel in that book twice. Well, our Constitution empowers only the general government to send military expeditions beyond the United States borders. It doesn't say we should or we have to. It just says that as a matter of constitutional law, only the general government sitting in Washington, D.C., under the commander-in-chief called the President of the United States, has authority to make foreign excursions. Again, that doesn't mean he should do that. But he does have the power to send expeditions to stop, defend the rights of the United States throughout the world, most pronouncedly on the high seas. And that is why, of course, President Jefferson sent Admiral Stephen Decatur to subdue the Barbary pirates. The Barbary pirates were charging a tribute to every ship that came through the Straits of Gibraltar. The Barbary pirates controlled utterly and absolutely the Mediterranean Sea, and the trade of the Mediterranean Sea was a lucrative trade. Well, instead of doing away with the Barbary pirates, the British just paid the toll. They paid the tribute. It was protection money. They didn't protect anybody, really, but they, if you didn't pay it, they'd wipe you out if your merchant ships came in there. Well, we got tired of it, and so we sent the Navy over there to negotiate with the devils, and they agreed to everything we wanted, signed an agreement, but little did we know that that's part of Islam. Part of Islam to agree with your enemy and then get him in a bad position and slaughter him. So they agreed. Jefferson and that whole crowd, they didn't understand Islam, just like people don't hear today, and they were incensed that they didn't keep their word. Well, keeping your word is not part of Islamic culture. It's part of our common law culture. It's part of our Christian culture that we are to keep our word, because God says there's only one thing that our God says he can't do. Only one thing. Can he make angels dance on the head of a pin? I suppose he probably could. Can he make a rock so big that he can't pick it up? Now, I suppose he could do that if he wanted to. But there is one thing he says point blank, I can't do. He says, I can't lie. The God who cannot lie. That's different, because every other god in the world is a liar and revels in it. Go read the stories about the Greek gods. All of them were liars. They thought it was funny. Well, the people in Islam, they think it's funny that they're God, and they lie, too, in order to get who they want in a bad position, slaughter them, rape them, and plunder them. Well, anyway, that's what the Barbary pirates did. And, of course, Jefferson then sent Stephen Decatur, and Stephen Decatur slaughtered them, and his life was saved by a sailor by the name of Reuben James from, I believe it was Connecticut. Reuben James. And several ships in our U.S. Navy have been named Reuben James. The most famous of those ships, the Nazis sunk off the coast of Iceland on the 31st of October, 1941. And the Roosevelt administration kept it secret. The Nazis jumped the gun and tried to start the war before everybody that was supposed to be invited showed up. So they waited for the Japs to attack Pearl Harbor. And when that happened, then they could pull the Germans in. But the famous song, well, the Kingston Trio made it famous. If you remember them, they were back, folk group back in the early 60s, late 50s too. What were their names? What were their names? Did you have a friend on the good Reuben James? And it's a story about the sinking, the U-boat, the German U-boat sinking the Reuben James off the coast of Iceland with a torpedo. Several men were killed, by the way, in those icy waters. Terrible tragedy. And it was all part of the plan of the government to hide it. Well, Article 2, let's talk about a little bit of that article, just starting in, clause by clause, blow by blow. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. A president of the United States of America. That's a nice ring to it. We still say it, United States of America. He shall hold his office, it says, during the term of 4 years. And, together with the vice president, chosen for the same term, be elected as follows. Now, what is it that is important to notice about this clause of our venerable Constitution? Well, the thing that strikes me between the eyes, as though a 12-pound sledge, is that our Constitution is not about what ought to be done. It's about how it ought to be done. It doesn't answer the question so much what, it answers the question how. Why is that important? Because it's another feature, a foremost feature of our common law. Our common law is not about what ought to be done or what a fellow hadn't ought to do. No, it's about how. It stresses H-O-W, how things ought to be done. That's why we say the most important, the largest, and the the one we ought to give the most attention to, the right. The responsibility, that's what a right is. It doesn't include responsibilities. It is a responsibility. The most important right of our Constitution is due process. The process that is due and owing to all concerned. It is a course that you get on. It is how, H-O-W, things are to be done. The way that we are to proceed, the way that the relationships between the three powers of government are to work, everything is about how. So our common law is due process. And when we get to Article 6 of our Constitution, where it says there that this Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land, that's not saying that our Constitution is the only thing there is. It's saying it is the supreme way, the way things are to be done, respecting the general government in Washington, D.C., not respecting the state governments. No, that's not what they were saying. This was written not with the express purpose not to interfere with state government, but to say how this monstrous animal that they were creating in Washington, D.C. was to be restrained and how it was supposed to work. And that's what he's saying here. That's what it is saying here, rather. These fellows, the people of the United States, are saying this. Together with the vice president, shall be elected as follows. That means how. H-O-W. Here we go. What does that mean? The president's executive power is the power to enforce the laws and treaties of the United States. Well, that's a nice start. Tells us exactly what the executive power is. Number one, to enforce the laws and treaties of the United States. Now, I'm not reading from the Constitution. I'm reading a comment by yours truly from the book, The Constitution and the Declaration of 76, a clause by clause and blow by blow, a common lawyer comments. And the president's tool for this duty are the armed forces of the United States and the militia called out. Those are the primary tools that the president of the United States wields. They're weapons. Because his enforcement duties require more resources than the other two branches of government, most federal employees are under direction of the executive branch, the president. back when I was a political animal and running for Congress a long time ago, at that time there were over 800,000 federal employees of the federal. No, I got that wrong. There were 3 million, right about 3 million. And when they had the government shut down, 800,000 of them didn't come to work. Of course, none of us noticed it because they never do much anyway, frankly. Just mill about smartly, look snotty, and boss people around and all that kind of stuff. I'm not exaggerating. That's what bureaucrats do for a living. But there are about 3 million of them. And that doesn't include the armed forces of the United States, which number up at least 1 million, I suppose. So the Congress doesn't have that kind of employees, and the judicial branch doesn't have that number of employees at all. Matter of fact, Congress and the judicial branch have no enforcement power at all. The raw force of the federal government, the raw force of any government in our country, whether states, the states or the general government in Washington, D.C., that raw force is under either the governor of the state or the president of the United States. That's a lot of power to have in a single set of hands. Before the war, between the northern and the southern tiers of the states, back beginning in the year 1861, at that time there were about 35 million Americans living in the United States. And there were 6,000 federal employees. At the end of that war, 4 years later, there were not 6,000, but 60,000. 60,000 federal employees. And the numbers of federal employees have been increasing exponentially ever since. And of course, our population is now over 300 million. The federal employees, a number in the millions, and I'm sure it's more than 3 million now, because now we have Homeland Security and all that blown in, who knows what else, all the bureaucracies that are out there. That's a lot of power. And all of those people in those bureaucracies have money and regular paychecks, and that gives them a lot of power to do political things. And there's a lot of power, of course, in the federal government anyway, and it's used to promote the party in power. That's taxpayer money. All of these things are ugly. How do you stop them is the question. And the only possible way is not by force, because the president has all the force. That can be a good thing, but it can be a bad thing, too. It just depends on who's in power and who's wielding the. That's why you don't want some goofus, like this fellow we had sitting in the White House for 8 years before, with his hands on his bony fingers on the levers of power, controlling military men. It would be an utter shame. I knew men that felt this, that were in the military, to think that they were under the command of such a creature. But they were. Of course, a lot of them got fired to talk that way, as you remember. Many generals were fired because they didn't have the right attitude, or the attitude that the commander-in-chief wanted. Simply put, our Constitution gives the president of the United States a near monopoly force, limited only by the other two branches' objections of words and the people's, that is, the militia's convictions, or lack thereof. Let me repeat that. Simply put, our Constitution gives the president of the United States a near monopoly of force, limited only by the other two branches' objections of words and the people's, that is, the militia's convictions, or lack thereof. And as a constitutional rule, however, the president of the United States has authority only over navigable waters, on the high seas, within the United States territories, the District of Columbia, federal lands, and enclaves within the states, such as federal courthouses, post offices, and military bases. Well, the power of the president was established as a monopoly of force, a near monopoly, I should say. But that doesn't mean that he always wins, because there's more power in the ground, in a groundswell of opinions of Americans. He's there because he was elected, and he can be unelected pretty quick. He can be impeached even I'm not advocating that right now. I'm just saying if you get somebody in there that deserves it, it can be done. We haven't impeached. No, we've impeached two presidents. Two. Nixon resigned because he knew they were going to impeach him. Impeachment means, that's an old Latin word, it means to catch by the foot. Really, it means to catch by the toe. It means just to grab a guy so he can't get away. And the reason it's called impeachment is because it's like the grand jury indictment. It grabs you and holds you for trial. The grand jury indicts you. The House of Representatives, according to the Constitution, the U.S. House of Representatives has the power to grab a federal office holder, a judge, a president, by the toe and hold him until the Senate has time to try him and either allow him to stay in office or throw him out. The only two presidents that have been impeached were President Johnson, not Lyndon Baines Johnson. This was the Johnson that was the vice president, right, under Abe Lincoln when Abe was shot and killed. He became president, and he was from Tennessee, and he tried to continue the policies of Lincoln in the South, which were very mild, very conciliatory, and the radical existentialist from the Northeast hated him for it because they wanted to subdue everybody and abuse them and kill them and jail them and execute Robert E. Lee and all those ugly things. And he didn't want to do that. So they tried to impeach him. He missed getting thrown out of office by one vote. One vote. It was a proverbial squeaker, as they say. And then the other fellow that was impeached was Slick Willie Bill Clinton. And he was impeached by the House of Representatives. Articles of impeachment were drawn up. Henry Hyde was the head of the Judiciary Committee, and he carried the articles of impeachment, as was the custom when it happened one time before, from the House over to the Senate. And they tried him, and Willie missed getting removed from office by one measly vote. But that keeps him on notice. Johnson didn't do anything to deserve impeachment. Bill Clinton did. Crimes and misdemeanors and anything else that they want to throw you out of office for is fair game. And he did a lot of nasty things, lots. I counted up one time, surrounding his presidency, in the wake, I should say, and surrounding, over 160 dead bodies. Over 160. You say, how do you know? Because I was running for Congress at the time, and we had the wherewithal to compile such numbers, and we did, and put it out there. And we began a movement to impeach the president. It wasn't my idea. I was just along for the ride. But the guy running the campaign said, I got a great idea. I said, what is it? He said, I just found a newspaper from 1974 from Little Rock, Arkansas. And on the headlines in the paper said, it said this, Clinton says now that Nixon has admitted he lied, he should leave office, or they should impeach him. And Bill Clinton was running for Congress in Arkansas, and that's what he said, now that Nixon has lied. Well, it had just been proven that Slick Willie had lied before the grand jury. I thought, well, that's a pretty good idea. What he said is you ought to start a movement to impeach Bill Clinton. Well, I said, that sounded like a good idea. He had the newspaper article and the headlines, and we did a press release and a press conference. And a long list of folks started to talk about impeaching Bill Clinton. And, of course, he was impeached eventually, and he wasn't thrown out of office, as I had said, but it was important that that happened. And people running for Congress were the ones that were clamoring for it, that long list of people, and they began to join it. Doing that kind of thing, though, is dangerous. I discovered that, too. Well, I'm going to ask whoever else is on this call that is in a position to control the board whether I should keep talking or whether I should quit or should I finish up now. If I don't hear anything, I'm going to keep talking.
Yeah, you can finish up with your,
you can finish up.
I'm back. I guess I was kicked off, and I guess I was talking to myself for a while. I do that all too often anyway.
It wasn't
but
very
go
long.
Right ahead.
You got good help, and they hollered at me and said, start talking, Brent. So yeah, it worked
out
great.
Looks like was kicked off, too. Jen, we kicked off around the same time I was?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for a while he was. Well, let me finish up by saying this.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Again,
go right ahead.
Yeah, I always appreciate the opportunity. NLA is nice enough to let me say a few words, and my comments are always my own. And don't think necessarily that people at NLA agree with what I say. They're just nice folk, and they say, Brent, you want to say a few words? And I do. I want to end by saying this. I just got confirmation today that a man who had written a book, a substantial book, a large book, a hardback book, and I don't remember the title. I think it's the name of the book was The Constitution versus the Bible. But his theme was that the Constitution of the United States is an Antichrist document, an Antichrist document. And he has a large following all over the country. He did a lot of research. He works hard. He made a lot of good points. I first heard this fellow, Larry Pratt, interviewed him a few years ago, and I was incensed listening to what he was saying. And so I called Larry, and I said, Larry, I want equal time on your show. Larry has a show out of Round Rock, a radio show out of Round Rock, Texas. And Larry said, okay, and he let me on. And Larry wanted to talk about something else, but that was okay. We talked about the Fifth Amendment. But ever since then, that's been a few years back, I thought about that, and I ended up doing a series about the Constitution on the radio to determine whether it was biblical or whether it was against the Bible or was it consonant with the Bible. I went through the whole thing, took several, well, I don't know, maybe 100 presentations, I don't remember. Well, I made a suggestion to a mutual friend between the both of us that we get together and have a public debate, a trial. And I suggested that we call it the Constitution of the United States on trial for being an Antichrist document. And I'll be the lawyer for the defense, and he'll be the lawyer for the prosecution, and we'll structure it like a trial and go at it. Now, I'm going to make that suggestion. I just received today how they wanted to go at it, the way we would do things, as I said a while ago, the process, the course, and it was pretty close to what I was thinking, too. But we want it to be friendly. We don't want it to be just ugly adversarial. That's not the point. We want it to be educational, informative, and because he thinks he knows his stuff, and I'm supposed to show up knowing my stuff a little bit. We can talk about it. He wants to put it live on the internet. I don't know that that's going to be possible. If somebody has the technical wherewithal, I suppose it could be. But that's going to be, I believe, on the 28th of next year. So it's late here where I am. It's been a long day. The 28th of next March is what I was going to say, and it's going to be in the evening. The 28th of next March in the evening is when they have scheduled. Now, if this thing actually plays out, I'll be posting it on the website, commonlawyer.com, and I'll be talking about it on the radio and let people know. I think it's going to take place in outside of Springfield, Missouri, someplace, the last word I got. But I look forward to it, and I'll let you know about it. Thank you again, John, and I'm glad you're back on and technical difficulties are over.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I was just abruptly disconnected and didn't even know I was. But in any event, I'm back. Okay, so I guess what we'll do is we'll just open up the call for callers. If anybody's got a question or a comment, you can get into the queue. We do have one person in the queue right now. To get into the queue, star 6 and a 1, star 6 and a 1. And let me just make a note here. You know, what we're doing here in the courts with bringing courts to join our case, you know, we're doing two things with it. Number one, we're using it to leverage and to make the point, because all of these cases really is evidence to our case. So it becomes evidence to the case that we have against the United States Supreme Court and the federal judiciary. And so that's on the one hand. On the other hand, of course, the opportunity is there because to bring the case from one court into another court, which in this case is a federal court, and the only decisions that could be made in a federal court on anything really is a constitutional issue. So when someone is in a jurisdiction that they don't belong in and they challenge that jurisdiction and that jurisdiction ignores them, well, the federal court is the proper place to go to shut that court down. And so since these courts don't have jurisdiction over the people because they're operating under civil law and not law, therefore they have no power and no authority over the people. And this has been going on since Rule 2 has become effective, which goes back to 1948. Now, I doubt that things changed on a dime back then. I'm sure it took a little time to acclimate across the United States, and it surely did acclimate across the United States. It opened up all of these potential town courts, which some of them may have been there before. I don't know. Wasn't around those days, so I don't know how long they've really been around, but I guess this, you can look to see when courts were established on the town level, the village level, and so on. But surely those courts didn't have any real authority. It's very interesting to see how they came around being. What happened, one of the first things, and was done quite early on, was really incorporating towns and counties and so on and so forth and bringing them under municipal law, which is the very same thing that Rule 2 did, is brings us under municipal law, which brings us to civil law, which is no law at all to us. But nevertheless, reality is the way one perceives it. The people perceive that it's law, and therefore for them it's law, you know. While the populace believes that these courts have authority, as long as you have faith in the authority of these courts, they will have the authority. Until we educate the people to bring them around to understand they have no authority at all. These municipalities, these courts, all of them are operating in jurisdictions unknown. So that's where we're bringing them into our case. Now, look it, we're not making any judgment on the innocence or guilt of any person under any of these things. Most of them are very obvious that the people are not guilty. You know, people having their children stolen and families destroyed, people having their homes taken with non-judicial foreclosures, whether it be the mortgage company or the tax, people not getting their due process. Again, they're in jurisdictions totally unknown. So any case that falls under that category, you know, we can pull into our court case. Now, as far as the problem, the court case itself, you know, the arguments that might be, argued in these courts, we have no need to hear of them because we're not here to make those decisions. We're not here to debate or discuss or hold up or anything, any of those things. So my point I'm trying to get to on this is we really don't want to discuss the details of any case. We'll discuss a mechanism of a case, something that is maybe how something might move in a court just kind of on the fringes of the court as far as jurisdiction is concerned and due process is concerned. But we don't want to know about the details. We don't need to know about the details. Now, generally speaking, we do ask people to write a synopsis. Very, very small synopsis. We're not asking for an affidavit, just a synopsis of what their court case is about. And it could be as simple as really making the point that this is a mortgage case. I mean, just the fact that it's a mortgage case and it's a non-judicial foreclosure, I mean, that we know right off the bat. If it's an IRS case, or if it's a, any other kind of a case, family court, you know, where maybe Child Protective Services are involved and they steal your children and they don't provide any real answers to the solutions for the problems. They just come, take your kids and just take ownership of them, so to speak. I mean, That is the most horrific, in my opinion, of all of these courts, and the most damaging, because the damages go so deep into the family. And, you know, the children are totally destroyed in many ways in these courts, being ripped out of their homes. All their stability that they may have had in a home is disappears. You know, think of what that does to a child as they get older. You know, it causes all kinds of insecurities and problems, needs psychological problems, all kinds of things, but mostly focusing, of course, on insecurities. Children need to be secure, you know, and that's the job of the parents. It certainly isn't the job of the courts. And if there is a problem, they should be assisting the family. This is not a criminal thing. It's a situation, part of society. And we should provide something to help work out the problems within a family. But certainly we don't want lawyers working these problems out, because they haven't got a clue what they're even talking about or what real law is to begin with anyway. Never mind, you know, the workings of a family. Okay, anyway, we'll take our first caller. It is Cody in Illinois. And again, if anybody's got a court case, we don't want to discuss the details, just the general idea about it. But go ahead, Cody.
Yeah, good evening, John. Cody in Southern Illinois. Hey, it's been 2 months since the Border Patrol took my phones, and I called them today, and they finally gave me a little bit more of an answer than they're just detained. They're not forfeited, but they're supposedly in some kind of a lab, and, you know, so they're probably going to ruin my data trying to crack my phones when, you know, I wasn't doing anything illegal crossing the border. And it's a real travesty. We need to indict these guys. Can we indict the Border Patrol for their Fourth Amendment violations?
Well, we're not at a place where we might want to do something like that. Doesn't mean that you can't indict a Border Patrol. You might be able to get an individual indicted. People are indicted, not organizations or groups of any kind. Or agencies or anything of that nature. So, but I mean, if an individual violated your unalienable right of whatever you think it is, and you can file a complaint and ask a grand jury for an indictment. You have that right to do that, right to access, but you're not going to get it, not yet, because there is no access to a grand jury. And if you know, when you file a complaint, they really take it to the DA and they make a decision whether they want to pursue it or not. It's not their decision. You know, that's why we need to take the courts back. People need direct access to the grand jury. And they may not have to really, let me finish this though. They may not have to really speak directly to the grand jury. They could get satisfaction just by speaking to the administration that has the open doorway to the grand jury, where they might be able to solve the problem and everybody will be happy and doesn't even have to go to the grand jury, simply by a few phone calls usually. That could be accomplished. And then, of course, if they can't, then the grand jury can hear it. And even they have the opportunity to try to solve the problem. Nobody ever speaks about that. But, you know, read the Magna Carta. It's clear, you know, that they're there to fix problems. But indictment is the final end, the results, if they can't get a fix between the person who's injured and the person that's injuring that person, send it into the court and let the jury decide. So, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a big problem, you know, and talking about the fines, you know, and not having a party made whole. It's interesting when you look at the Justice Department, or I think it was Justice Department, there were some big fines, I think, for the banks, you know, billions of dollars. It's interesting. I'm sure that money just, you know, goes into the Justice Department to fund the federal mafia rather than, you know, going, if they really feel the banks injured people, you know, why aren't they, you know, paying that out? So it's a really good point on that. That's all I had. Just something's got to be done, this Fourth Amendment violations. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has been, you know, talking about it. So there's a lot of attorneys that are, you know, saying the same thing, that this, they're absolutely violating the Fourth Amendment, you know, by the way they're treating electronics right now when they're at the border. So, anyway, thank you. Have a good night.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll take our next call. And again, you know, if anybody feels they have a case that they need to get before the grand jury from that perspective or whatever, you know, there's really nothing that could be done until we get this reestablished. And that's what we're trying to do, is to get, you know, grand juries local, the people access in their local areas to the grand jury by creating administrations in every county for individuals to administer to the juries, both grand jury and trial juries, bringing them together for orientation and working on solving problems and being the investigative body for the grand jury, or even a spearhead to open up doors for the grand jury to go speak to themselves or whatever to somebody in an agency or whatever the case may be. But until that happens, we don't have just courts. We don't have courts of justice. We have to take back our courts. We have to take back our republic. That is one of the ways we consent to our government, is by controlling our courts of law and deciding on who needs to be indicted and who doesn't, and making a decision on innocent or guilt, and making the decisions on how to restore that individual. That's our job, and it's a very important job. People need to step up and take that job, otherwise they're giving away their liberty. And that's the most important, in my opinion, most important liberty is the right of justice, having justice. And underneath the right of justice flows everything. All of our rights flow under the right of justice. We have a right of a court of justice. Okay, Rebecca from Arizona, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
My husband and I emailed some questions in. Because he has court on Wednesday, and we did the grand jury, the denial of jurisdiction, and so basically,
so we did an amicus curiae for you.
Yeah. So okay. And they received it and everything. So you know, he doesn't know why they're bringing him into court, trying to
Yeah, look, they're doing what they want to do because they're evil. They're doing what they want to do because the money to be made there, power and authority to be made there, and it just rolls down. It's like a dirty snowball, you know, just going down the hill. And they're going to look at – people have to have patience and endurance. Mm-hmm. And if people aren't willing to have patience and endurance, then we're not going to get our nation back. We're not going to get a republic back. Look at all the patience that Trump has. Look about all that's being thrown at him. And the patience that he's got, at the end we're going to win there, there's no doubt about it. But nevertheless, we have to have the endurance and the patience. And so when we go into the court, they ignore us. A lot of these courts that we file these papers in will ignore us, and that's okay. They're on file. Things are moving. We'll go to the next step. At some point, they're going to wake up, and at some point, they're going to find the end of justice, and it's going to be applied to them if they haven't turned things around by that time. And we will be doing lots of indictments. We intend on indicting every single judge that denies the process that we are going through. We will file an indictment on them. And matter of fact, the grand jury has come together and has already made that decision that any judge that resists and denies and rejects is owed an indictment. So at the point, we go to the amicus curiae. They throw it out. They ignore it. We move then to the motion to move for the court into the federal district court. You know, they try to neutralize that, make a few phone calls, deny that, and move on. We go to the end of 30 days. We're going to give more than 30 days, but we go to the end of the 30 days, and then we file an indictment. And nobody does anything. Nobody gets arrested, and we keep going, and we keep filing, and we keep indicting, and we keep moving cases, and we keep doing the things we have to do that's proper and lawful. And at some point in time, when critical mass is met by that point in time where the collapse, the final collapse of the deep state, and then there'll be a power vacuum, because the judges won't know what to do anymore. They'll be stuck in a place where the status quo is not the good thing for them to do anymore, because there's no more protection. you know, the whole thing crumbles and falls apart. And that's when the people have that opportunity. It's like, and it's a, you know, look, it's a doorway that is unlocked for a short period of time. Or, you know, it's like, you know, if you ever look at some of these things that NASA's doing and watch these documentaries, you know, there are windows of time where they take off with a rocket or some, you know, to send some kind of a ship or something, you know, like the explorers on Mars or something. You know, they have to have that window of time to hit that right time to make the shortest distance because everything's moving and orbiting. But we have to hit that window of time, that window of opportunity. And that's what we're looking for. And we need to pressure, file, pressure, file, and hit that point with also critical mass. And that's when we, the people, will take back our courts. And we will do the same thing in the political process to take back our political process and get rid of politics, because politics don't belong in our in our way of being as an American, as our heritage. Jefferson made it clear on the one hand that the courts are the problems. The judges are the ones that's going to destroy this nation. They're the ones that's going to take us over, and they'll be the sort of the oligarchy behind the scene. And he was right. But Washington, he came at it from, he had a, you know, his perspective, from a different perspective. He saw the political parties as the destruction of this nation, and both of them were right. Look at the nonsense going on. Look at how you know, self-evident truth isn't even realized by a lot of people. I mean, that's how dumbed down and how bad it is. Because when you look at these things, it's self-evident by seeing what's happening that Trump is clean as a whistle, you know. But these other people, you know, the doors are going to swing the other way soon. But in any event,
I guess our biggest question is, though, like, what happens if she throws him in jail again? He's already been unlawfully arrested and thrown in jail. So that's our biggest concern.
Yeah,
right now.
Well,
she has no reason to even bring him in court, period. So now she's trying to hold him in contempt, and he doesn't really know what to say or do. And
she's worried that he's going to try to throw
him back in jail.
He can rest on our paperwork, and you know, they can ignore it and deny it, but, you know, look at, by just bringing it up and resting, having an extra copy with it, because, you know, may not even have it. Have a few extra copies with you and repass it on to the judge. But look at, rest in the fact that they don't have jurisdiction. Look at, I'm challenging, the grand jury has challenged jurisdiction on my behalf. At my request, I asked them for some kind of, intervene in the case. And they did so by the process called an amicus curiae, which brings the attention of the court of a legal situation, particularly in this case, a legal situation that is an unlawful process taking place. And we're bringing it to their attention concerning the jurisdiction that they think they have, particularly, and the fact that a jurisdiction unknown or a jurisdiction anything other than a court of law, there can be no due process. Okay?
Hey,
due process required.
John, this is Frank. I guess my biggest concern is I'm just going to basically tell this judge that there's a cause for jurisdiction in front of this court right now, and that we cannot proceed until that's been answered.
That's a good way to put it. You know? And what that'll do, hopefully, is buy more time, because it may put a little stress on the judge to say, maybe I'd better think this out a little further. And so you're looking for time, and then, you know, and then 30 days transpires, then we move to the next step, moving it for cause, okay? Then there'll be another problem.
Here's the other thing. They signed for it last week, but I've been checking the court website, and it's not posted on the website anywhere. And see, this judge has a tendency to deny everything that comes in front of her in regards to other people, such as Liberty Alliance, my wife filing paperwork to show cause for jurisdiction, saying that parties
are not
part of this case.
Hmm. I'm missing this. What parties are not part of the case? Say that again.
Okay. When I was incarcerated, my wife had filed paperwork on my behalf to show cause for jurisdiction. The judge denied that, stating she was not a party to the case. Now, we go further into what we filed. Liberty Alliance filed on my behalf.
Well, the grand jury filed.
Well, grand jury, sorry. But yes, what they had filed on my behalf. Last week, the clerk signed for it, and it typically takes 2 days for it to get onto the court's website so you can see that it's been filed. Nothing's on
okay.
there.
All right. Nothing's well, listen, this is back. What you could do. Listen, you know, we have a paper, and I meant to put this up online, and I'll put it up tomorrow. It'll be in front of all of the other papers that we filed under grand jury. And if you highlight grand jury, go into action against the jury, action against the judiciary. Okay. Right now you'll see filed August 17, 2019, and then all the others. Well, right on top of that, I'm going to place a paper which is a paper, I'm trying to think, I think it was done in the way of a mandamus, an order, okay, that they must file this. But I'll file that paper up on this, I'll put this paper up on the website on, like I said, first and foremost. It's 2 pages, and you read through that, and you can read a couple of those things to the court. And you can tell them, you know, that the papers being filed in the federal district courts concerning these kinds of cases and stuff are being filed under the order of the grand jury to the clerk to file and not break the law. And when they,
we
when
did
someone,
file
yeah,
order.
You,
oh,
you filed the,
I guess
the two
we did not. I guess we did not
no,
file the mandamus.
You know what? I think what I'll do. I'll talk to Jim. And maybe we'll do a one-pager in front of these papers. You could take the paper that I'm going to put up there, and it's 2 pages, okay? You download them, and you can make some copies, bring it into the court. It applies to that clerk as much as any court clerk in any court, okay? It applies to them all. They have a job to do. When that clerk gets that paper, that clerk's only job is to file. If they reject, it's only because there's a prima facie defect. Mm-hmm. And if there's a prima facie defect, such as maybe a name wrong or an address wrong or some other thing, you know, something prima facie, something very simple, okay? If there's a prima facie defect, they must let the person know what that defect is, and then they have the opportunity to correct that defect. Other than that, that clerk does not have the power or the authority to judge that paper in any way, shape, or form. Their duty is to file. Now, the law says that once a paper is filed, okay, and this is their law that they must follow, it's the equity, they must follow, otherwise they are breaking the law, and they can be, you can go after them even for criminal activities because it is a crime to remove a paper that's in the judicial process. Okay, you cannot remove it. It's not to be defaced, destroyed, or anything.
Yeah.
Okay, related nothing. It must go through the process. And a judge trying to intervene on those papers and say, don't file that paper, that's a crime, and we got to make that clear. We made it clear to the clerk up in the Northern District, and I believe this is why our papers continue to go through. We made it absolutely crystal clear. So we'll get that paper up there. You can put that up there.
Okay.
And then
let me finish.
I know you have more questions.
Okay.
Hold on. I know you have more questions,
okay,
but let me finish. Because this isn't just for you. This is for everybody that's involved in this, okay? But we will make a correction to the paper by adding a cover sheet or a letter to or a mandamus. We'll do it in the form of a mandamus, an order to the clerk to file. And we'll lay out the law, like we did in this paper. And again, you can download it and say, this is what was filed in the federal district courts, and the clerks are filing everything, and they're not rejecting them, removing them, or destroying them. They're filing, and that's their job to do. That's a crime, Your Honor, and I want to report a crime. You can go that far right there in the courtroom, on for the record. I'm reporting a crime right now, okay?
Okay.
They may not like that, and I don't know whether you want to push the court. Depends on how you feel about that. You can do it in a very polite and humble way, maybe, but nevertheless, the paper in itself makes the point that it's a crime. And if the judge, if a judge, now think about this. This is in the law, okay? If the judge tells the clerk, intimidates the clerk in any way, shape, or form to remove a piece of paper from that process, from that judicial process, that mechanism that's moving forward, that's supposed to deal with all of these papers, if a judge intimidates the clerk, orders the clerk to remove that paper, 20 years in jail, that's what the law says.
Okay.
And we do quote that in there. And that's why I think our papers are kind of sticking where we're at. We've had problems with our papers ever sticking anywhere. But we've been really hardcore on this, and then we've indicted the judge over this, and the clerk see we mean business, and I think that's why it's happening. Now, if the clerk won't remove it, I mean, just think about this. The judge taking his fingers and sticking it into those files and pulling that out, wow. That's not their business. That's not their job. That's a paper that needs to go through a process, and it should go through the process of the court at least. At worst case, they should, you know, if they want to take that out, they can rule on it and make a decision. See, they don't want to rule on it because they know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the problem. But yeah, but that's what you can do. I'll get that up tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good.
And if there are any problems with that, get a hold of Jan and he'll get a hold of me. But I'm going to make a note to put that up tomorrow.
Okay. That was all of our questions.
Okay, is that it?
That was all of our questions, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's move to our next caller. And again, if anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 to get into the queue. We're taking 412 area code. Give us your first name and your state.
Jim, Pennsylvania.
How you doing, Jim?
Okay, I got a brief question for you. Is a non-judicial foreclosure the same thing as an attainer?
No, I don't believe it is. I'm trying to think. What's the definition of an attainer?
I had looked it up, and it seemed very similar to non-judicial foreclosure. But I'm reading it right from the U.S. Constitution, no bill of attainder, or ex post facto a law shall be passed. Bill of attainder, but I'm using the word isolating it to attainer. Is that the same as a non-judicial foreclosure?
Well, maybe Brent, if you're here, maybe you can comment on that as far as the meanings. I've looked it up before, but I just don't recall what it was. But I remember reading that in the Constitution.
The word attainer. That doesn't ring a bell. Attainer? No, it doesn't ring a bell. I don't know everything. I've discovered that. I discover that daily, by the way. But that one
Where is it called, the Bill of Attainder or something like that in the Constitution? Do you recall?
Let me spell it to make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly. ATTAINDER.
Oh, attainder. A bill of attainder. Yeah, that's in the Constitution. And the Constitution forbids the federal government or the Congress, the general government, from passing any bill of attainder. And a bill of attainder is a bill that targets a specific person and says that what they did was a crime. If Congress tries to pass a law that says Donald Trump committed a crime, why? Well, when he did this over here, we just passed a bill after he did it saying that that was a crime. that doesn't happen very often, but there are those cases where such things arise. Did that arise on a piece of paper that you got from the government, or somebody said they did that to you? Or, well, how did you hear about this?
Well,
I'm just trying to put it together with the idea of what we're doing. Concerning the judicial, non-judicial foreclosures, which is something different, okay? So I recall now particularly how we can even approach this. Look at, as Brent said, a bill of attainder is, let's say someone does something and someone in government doesn't like it, so they get a law through and then they try to arrest the person for a law that didn't exist at the time that they, you know, apparently broke it. And that's what that's talking about. That's correct, right, Brent?
Yeah, without a trial. It would be Congress or a state legislature declaring somebody a criminal. That's really what it amounts to. If they pass a bill of attainder, it would declare somebody a criminal. That's the result of it, without a trial, without a jury. They don't. A legislative body doesn't have judicial powers. Separation of powers forbids that. Only the courts would have the power to a grand jury indictment and a jury trial and all those things would be necessary. Back to you.
Okay, thanks. So now, a non-judicial foreclosure, okay, which is an oxymoron. I mean, just think about the non-judicial foreclosure, taking something away from you without going through the judicial process. I mean, that's that totally lacks due process. I mean, on its face, it's an oxymoron. And only that can happen in under civil law, which is what these courts think they're operating under, but the they're under a false understanding of that, and they're going to have to pay a heavy price if they don't if they continue in this, because they changed all these laws and rules. They changed all these this law, you know, to a civil law by a rule, Rule 2, and which the Congress gave them the power and authority to write the rules. But the United States Supreme Court, working in collusion with the Bar Association, who was really directing this whole thing both in Congress and in the Supreme Court, really moved it in a tricky way to try to use a rule to combine law and equity. And it combines neither, because civil law is not equity and civil law is not law. Civil law is municipal law. It's the law, law of the state, or the law of the city, shall I say. It is comes from Babylon. It's Roman law. It's Justinian law. It's Roman Catholic Church law. The Roman Catholic Church ruled the known world in their day for 1,250 years under that kind of a civil law. They called it something else, but it's the very same thing through Justinian law, which really was just a rewriting of the same stuff and you know, putting a new name to it ultimately. But in any event, all of that is unlawful, and that's what they're operating under. Now, a non-judicial foreclosure. It's very interesting that a non-judicial foreclosure takes place in a court. I find that extremely, you know, it's almost a joke to begin with. Because to do a non-judicial foreclosure, what they're really doing is they're working behind the scenes, changing ownerships, changing all the paperwork, and playing a paper game in the background. And they file with the court this non-judicial foreclosure that is never going, or never supposed to be going, never going to be heard in a court at all. Okay, no judge is going to sign it. It's just applied there, and it's all done to make it look like it's lawful. It's operating under the color of law. They're making believe that this thing is lawful so that, you know, the people don't catch on. And when the people fight and argue against it, they find themselves in a court. But generally, under certain circumstances, I'm sure we've heard about judges who will sign the papers at the end, but generally they don't. Usually they're left unsigned. Even no matter how much arguing that goes on inside of a court where people are trying to argue against it, you know, no signature, no judge usually puts their signature on it. And so they're just trying to take you home without a due process. Now, if they could take it away with due process, if they can prove their case, why not just take it into a court of law? Why go through all these games? Well, that's because they can't. They can't prove that you owe them anything. That's the problem that they got. And that's both on the tax and the mortgage side of things. There is no proof. And so that's a major problem for them. And remember, you know, these mortgage companies that buy them from the banks and everything, well, just think about what's going on here. The bank didn't even have any skin in the game here. They went to the Fed window to get the money. So they're not part of this. But, you know, they get their 0.5% or 1%, whatever the points are for, you know, taking the loan process through and bringing it to the Fed window and making, you know, really an electronic change. No real money ever changes anyone's hands here. And but once they've done that, their business is over with you. And yet they start to collect money. They send you bills and they start to collect the money. And what do they do with all that money? Well, look at the Fed gets some of that, really, but they get it from a different perspective. They get some of that, but a lot of that money goes into the bank. It's a profit thing. They sell it to these, you know, shell companies. They'll call them mortgage companies. Lawyers get involved in a lot of this because it's big money, a lot of money involved. And so the mortgage companies go and they buy up these mortgages, quote unquote, and they're now another party that have no skin in the game. Yeah, they may have paid to buy this packaging, but has nothing to do with you. It's really something that's been monetized, and that's unlawful. And so the whole thing is just unlawful, and yet they do it, and they're getting away with it. But the challenging of a jurisdiction is one way to go with that, and that's what we do, of course, with the joinder, challenge the jurisdiction, and reveal the crime. You know, we do lay out how the crime takes place and how they use these, you know, robo-signers and start to change the ownership of the property and just getting in there and changing all kinds of paperwork and making the mechanisms, whatever is necessary to make this change. But it's monetizing mortgages. And again, that's a crime. The robo-signing, another crime. Trying to take property without due process, another crime. I mean, the crimes add up, and even securities crime is involved here. So it builds. Okay. Anything else on that?
No, John, the purpose of my call was to just for me to get a better understanding of the word attainder.
Right. Okay, well, again, attainder, as Brent said, and as I think I clarified it to some degree, is if, you know, again, you do something and the legislators go out there and make it a crime after the fact, that's what I think is they're talking about there in the Constitution. Again, Brent, did I get that right on that?
John?
All right, anyway, you know, we're going to be covering that in the course. I haven't really done deep research on that, but I'm just familiar a little bit with it. But go ahead, Brent.
It took me a while to mute. But what it comes down to is this. The Constitution of the United States forbids the Congress or the Congress from passing any bills of attainder. Bills of attainder have been used in the English-speaking world. They're against the common law, and they were declared as such, but they have happened. And we've had them even attempted here in this country. Some of the states have included prohibitions of bills of attainder in their state constitutions. Attainder is an old Norman French word. The Normans were the ones that conquered England in the year 1066. And when they came off the coast of France, they had conquered Normandy. They were Norwegians. They lived there for about 160 some years, and they'd picked up the French tongue, but they spoke a bastardized form of French called Norman French. And that became the language of the government for a couple hundred years at least after they got there. And so in our courts we have all these words that we still use, and attainder is one of them, petition is one of them, a whole lot of words we use, and still in the courts some become very familiar. But attainder is one of those, and attainder means to it's an old word that was used to talk about taking a person's life, his liberty, or his property. And when you stop to consider, that's all you got in this life. You've only got three things. You've got your life, you've got your freedom, maybe your freedom, and you've got your property, and you have rights in your property, and you have property in your rights. Some rights or some property consist of tangible rights, like land, and other property consists of rights that are intangible, like the right to freedom of speech, the responsibility of that. But Article 1, Section 9, Clause 3 says no bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. But we're concentrating just on the bill of attainder. And it was used originally to execute people. During the 1600s, the King of England went into Britain. Well, he wanted to get his throne back. He was ran out by putting William and Mary on the throne in the late 1600s, and he was a Scotsman, and he came back. What was his name? Was it James? I don't know what his name. Anyway, he went back to Scotland, and the Scottish legislature compiled a list of something like 3,000 names of persons who were not loyal to him, and they passed a bill outlawing them. Well, that means you can kill them on sight. Winston Churchill tried that after World War II. He wanted bills of attainder passed against the Nazis that he thought ought to be executed. He thought that if he did that, the Parliament passed a bill of attainder, or the cabinet, the Queen's cabinet, or the King's cabinet could get one through, there wouldn't be any trial, and he could just get rid of all the red tape, and when they found them, they'd just take them and string them up someplace or shoot them, whatever was handy. That's a bill of attainder. A bill of attainder is a bill passed by the government, usually the legislative body, that outlaws or says a certain person or a certain number of persons' property, their life or their liberty or a combination thereof, the government's going to take it from them as soon as they see them. One fella, I don't remember who this was, it was in England, he was locked up in France in the Bastille. He was imprisoned. And his name was on that list of about 3,000 people that were supposed to be report for trial. No, not report, report for sentencing. There is no trial. But the bill of attainder said, these people on this list, and they sent the word out all over the country, you must report to Edinburgh, I think it was, for sentencing, not trial, sentencing. Just report. We've already, the legislature has already said you're guilty. That ends that. Come in. Well, if you didn't come in, the bill of attainder said further, if you didn't show up when they found you, you would be drawn and quartered. That was even worse. So they told this fellow over in France, he was in prison, the Bastille, he was some nobleman, some English nobleman. They said, look, if you don't break out of jail and get back over here, they're going to come over here and take you out of the jail and draw and quarter you. So he had to devise a plan to get out of jail, because if he'd have stayed there, they'd found him for sure. That's the madness of putting legislative power or judicial power in the hands of a legislature. People complain about the independence of the judiciary. And if I may, John, just drop a footnote. I'm passionate about this. The judges and the juries and the appellate courts are crazy sometimes. There's no doubt about that. But I don't want them under the control of the Congress of the United States. That'd be even worse. If you look at the buffoons that we see in politics running for president, clowns, maybe clowns would be a better word. It's a circus. Well, these people are congressmen. They have no pride. They have no dignity. They don't have a clue what they're talking about. For them, it's just all, I get paid and it's fun, and let's have fill our sensual lust and enjoy ourselves. Well, I don't want those kind of people running the courts. Now, I know the courts aren't doing that great a job. I understand that. Matter of fact, they do a very terrible job in many cases. But I don't want them. I don't want the powers of government, personally. I've come to this conclusion. I don't want them, one power of government being controlled by another. And when you have a bill of attainder, that's what you've got. You've got the legislature just taking the judicial power to themselves, or eliminating it entirely, and eliminating entirely the power of the other branches of government. Oh, just report, as that bill said in Scotland. Just report for sentencing. We've already just declared you guilty. That's a bill of attainder. Back to you, John.
Okay, thank you. And what I was thinking of, I got it confused here. I was looking here. It's, I got it confused with ex post facto law. And so that's when a you do something and it's not written against the law, you know, in the equity side of court, I would guess, of course. But it's not written in as a crime, and then legislators write it up, put it in as a crime, and then they try to come out after you. At the time you committed that quote-unquote crime, it wasn't a crime then because it wasn't on the books. So you can't, that's called an ex post facto. So a bill of attainder, as Brent said, and it's different than what I was thinking. Now let me just read what Black's law says here. A legislative act, and it's pretty much what Brent said, a legislative act directed against a designated person, pronouncing him guilty of an alleged crime, usually treason, without trial or conviction, according to the recognized rules of procedure, and passing sentence of death and attainder upon him. Okay, so again, it's trial by legislation, it seems. So anyway, hopefully that clears that up.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. Good night.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's go to our next caller. If I can find my browser here. Okay. Okay, next person is a 209 area code. You got the mic. What is your first name and your state?
Hi. You know, I'd like to be honest, I'm a little bit nervous about giving my name out considering the state of affairs.
Well, just your first name, right now. Jim, James, John.
Like
what's
I said.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, that's all right.
Thank you, sir. I really do appreciate that. I do want to say up front, though, like, I do regret not coming to the site more often. I didn't realize how much you guys have been talking, and it's really good to see that at the same time. Now I have a mountain of stuff that I want to go through. But I actually there was a few things I thought about just sitting here listening to you guys, but one of the things is that I realized you guys talked about an ex post facto law. And I think this is something actually really big. I might be wrong, but basically, you said is they basically changed the rules to declare something unlawful, right?
Right. Ex post facto law is when you do an act and it's not unlawful, and then the legislators see that act or whatever, and then they make a law to make whatever act you committed a crime. Well, because you did it before it was a law, you can't be convicted of that crime. You can, you know, if it is really even a crime, but you can't be convicted of it. That's the point. That's an ex post facto law. A law written after the fact.
Okay, well then, so I'm sure you've heard about the whole Ukraine issue that's going on. I say issue
right.
Loosely. Because, this is really blowing up very...
Well, ex post facto actually works in that situation, because what they did is they actually went down and changed the rules, the Congress did. Somehow they went and changed the rules concerning the definition, concerning the... goodness, what was it called? It was a... I can't think of what it was that was done, but basically they changed the rules, and in that process of the rules, now it changed the whole, but that was after the fact, okay? And the rules required that there has to be first-hand knowledge, okay? And that's what is in a court of law, and the rules required that too, that there be first-hand knowledge. They removed that first-hand knowledge and changed that so that a person in hearsay could be applied towards this against Trump as far as trying to bring them up as a witness and using hearsay, where in the rules of law and also the rules of what they were doing as far as their process of their rules, how they act, also that was changed after the fact. So that would be ex post facto right there.
Yeah, and that would be the evidence that maybe the Trump's people have been waiting for. Realistically, I mean, this is the worst that it's ever been. How much they're all going on national television and just smiling and lying straight to everyone's face.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, you know that they've been set up to do that. I don't know if you know that. Okay.
Oh yeah,
They're being played. And everything that they're talking about is they're talking about themselves, their own guilt, and this is all part of the plan to bring all this out. It looks really bad for Trump, for the people who aren't really paying attention. So the people who are just regular Joe and get to the CNN news and believes whatever's being said there, they don't understand. But the whole process is going to turn on them, because those people are going to be brought through the process. Because they're going to find out that really they've always been talking about themselves. They were the ones guilty with dealing with the Russians and other governments. They were the ones guilty of doing something with the voting. They were the ones guilty of lots of things that they're talking about. So, it's all going to turn on them soon.
Yeah, I really hope so, because, I'm I will be honest. It's been really hard not to be scared by what I'm seeing in the news. I mean, everyone's seen plenty of movies, and it's definitely gotten dark in the last, you know, the last years. I don't know if you've ever seen a Game of Thrones, which I find actually kind of funny that you know, Donald Trump actually has made a few references to that in his I can't think of the word. You know, I'll say campaign, so they don't have a better word. You know, like he had a, I think this might actually have been a fake picture. I don't know. I didn't look back into it. But I saw him actually signing a poster of him. It was, you know, kind of a designed picture where it's the Game of Thrones lettering that says the wall is coming. And, you know, a lot of people say that he didn't bring things up without an intention. And what I just want, and, you know, the thing that keeps coming to me is there's an episode in the sixth season of Game of Thrones, and I don't know if you've watched it, but it's actually, I'll just come out and say it. Basically, the evil woman of the story blows up the entire church, the main church of the Seven Kingdoms, kills countless people because she's about to be put to trial, and basically becomes the queen of the Seven Kingdoms because of that. And of course, she ends up dying. I mean, how the show goes, but I mean, I just can't help but think that this is some type of, you know, warning without a warning, that these people are psychopaths, and they will think about how, you know, the craziest person you've met in your life and what they will do to cover up their mistakes or crimes. And then, I mean, I understand that you guys don't seem to be talking about things that I like to read about, but you know, there are a lot of very dark theories out there.
Right. And well, look, the Game of Thrones, I've never watched, so I don't even know what it's about. But I listened to what you were saying, and I got an idea of what you're talking about. And it sounds like you've just woken up to this nightmare about a year or so ago, correct?
Actually, that was, ironically, a year ago or so is exactly when I watched the two videos on Trump on your front page. I'd had a couple of your books, and I saw the website, and I realized I'd never gone out and checked it. And I was just kind of feeling a certain way around Trump at that time, really. And in a good way. And
let me tell you,
I cried when I saw your videos on the front page because it opened my eyes. The 8-minute video of him, during his campaign speech. I mean, it's for anyone that. You know, can actually judge people with any degree of accuracy. I mean, he's either the worst one of them all, or he is genuine. You know what I mean? It's after having seen that, any person listening to it with any type of rational reasoning has to come to that conclusion. And so not to go off on it. About a year.
Well, look at, you know, when I got involved in this quite some time ago, about 20 years ago really is when I started to get involved and my eyes started to be opened, and it was through the IRS, and then it grew from there, and I was just totally, appalled by how much corruption is in this country of ours, our nation. And the courts are totally 100% corrupt. It's almost impossible to get justice anywhere in these courts. And our political process is totally destroyed also. It's just nothing but corruption. It's the criminal on the right or the criminal on the left, and very rarely does a good person be able to squeeze past that and get into office. But again, what could one man do, you know? That's the amazing thing about Trump, you know? He came out of left field. No one saw him coming, and he made it through. And he understands a heck of a lot more than I ever realized that he understood. And he's the right guy for the right time with the right attitude, the right abilities. He uses the tools around him, and it's just working well. But, you know, when I first got involved in this and realized how serious this problem is and the evil behind our government and actually the governments of the world, the New World Order movement, it was really, really frightening. And when the people fear their government, you have tyranny. But when the government fears the people, you have liberty. Now, with that in mind, we're at that point. We've come to the precipice. Literally, it was 2016. And in my mind, if Hillary Clinton got in at that point in time, that was the end of America, in my opinion. I strongly feel that from the knowledge and things that I know and seen and understand. And for Trump to get in there at that point in time, it was the end game. It was the end. It was it. I mean, even our paper tonight that we read talks about the destruction let me read this as a matter of fact. Hold on. Because this is pretty powerful. Just listen to this. I'm going to reread these couple of paragraphs that I read earlier. Okay. We constantly hear congressmen, senators, presidents, and even the United States Supreme Court justice refer to America as a democracy. Are our elected servants that ignorant of our Constitution, our history, and our heritage? Or is there a methodical, covert conspiracy hell-bent on destroying our republic? Just how close are we? Or should I say, how close were we? You see, I'm seeing it from a different perspective now. My fear has gone. I mean, I've always had a little fear here or there, but you got to do what you got to do, and you keep going. But my fear is almost gone. But let me finish reading this. Or should I say, how close were we? I think the following says it all. When President Barack Obama, during the 2016, listen to these words, during the 2016 White House Correspondents' Dinner, where he predicted Hillary Clinton's presidency in 2017. It was the end of his era, and he believed that Hillary was going to win the election, and this is right before the election. You know, I think it was in the fall or late summer. And this is what he said. The end of the republic has never looked better. Think about that.
What?
You know, people don't even understand that.
What
he just said. You know, we are a republic. We're not a democracy. That's what this paper is all about. But then it goes on. And then the unexpected happened. By God's mercy and divine providence, the coup failed. President Trump was elected in her stead and declared, in contrast, in America, and this is what Trump said, okay, in America, the people govern, the people rule, and the people are sovereign. I was elected not to take power, but to give power to the American people where it belongs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty powerful. That was a speech that Trump made in September of 2018 addressing the United Nations General Assembly in New York, okay? But that's the contrast. We were there. The end of the republic never looked better. You know, it was time for the collapse, time for the destruction of America, time for the New World Order moved in, the boots on the ground, and we were in trouble. Okay?
Oh,
and yet,
God.
On the turn of a dime, the 2017 election saved this nation. That's the will of God, in my opinion. And, you know, ever since then, or actually before that, but really pretty much then, you know, my fear started to really disappear almost, because now, you know, we're not in as big a risk of being, arrested and so on as we were, you know, back a couple of years earlier. But the key thing here at National Liberty Alliance is we are 100% on point. Anything we do, we're following history. We're following Supreme Court rulings, precedents. We're following the law. And so we have the sources of everything we talk about, and we're doing everything lawfully, the process, everything we're doing. We're being creative, no doubt about that. But there's nothing that we're doing that hasn't been done before, okay? What we're doing has never been done in the way that we're doing, by combining numerous things together to execute what we're trying to do. And really, we're doing what our founding fathers said to do. When the nation goes rogue, we have a right to, change our government. We have a right to change the players. And if Congress is as bad as the courts are, and they won't do their job through impeachment, then we, the people, have to step up and do it in two ways. Number one, we have to take our political process back and get these people off the ballot, okay? And number two, and most importantly, the way we're really going to win is to take control of the courts and then bring them to trial. That's about it. And that's where we're at right now. Okay.
But
so,
is there anyone in your organization?
Let me just finish this one point for you particularly. Knowledge will lessen and remove your fear. Get knowledge. Whenever I was attacked by the government, and believe me, I've been attacked by the government over the past 20 years many times, threatened with all kinds of stuff, and particularly in court. And as soon as I'd get a letter from them or something, you go into a little depression and concern, but you say, well, okay, let me figure out what I'm going to do. And then I just start studying. And then I start to feel powerful because I pull up this and I pull up that. I find, a lot of Supreme Court rulings, particularly. The United States Supreme Court is the boss of these federal district courts and actually all courts, in a sense, as far as the violation of any of our unalienable rights is concerned, you know. So you get empowered, knowledge empowers you, and it'll remove a lot of your fear. But go ahead.
Pardon me. Is anyone in your organization like in contact with Trump? Because I find it very surprising that no one in his administration has brought up this ex post facto tidbit, mm-hmm. because that's their big, that'll expose them all, honestly, because they've been, I don't know how much on internet media you are, how much you of it that you watch, but the censorship is it's war. It's literally gotten to the point of a cold war. This is a cold war. They have censored conservatives on Google, on YouTube. They are editing search algorithms. They're editing their autocomplete. They're proven to do this. There have been multiple whistleblowers that have left.
Yeah, but all of that is going to change. They know all about that. We know of all about that. We're moving on, and look at I believe a lot of people in the news media is going to be arrested also for treason. They empowered and they were able to provide the cover, okay, the news media. And so I think that's going to be part of the process also. But look at Rudy Giuliani anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, Rudy, he recently, he's been making the rounds, and he spoke about the fact that they changed the rules and the law. There's also a congressman up there. I'm trying to think of his name.
Jim Jordan?
Yeah, I heard him talking too, but maybe he was the one who brought it up. But they were brought up this fact that they had changed the rules. That's how I learned about it. And they know what that means. It's ex post facto. They understand that. But look, there's nothing there anyway. There's got to be a crime. There is no crime. I mean, you can't impeach a president without a crime. The Congress can only bring it to the Senate, and the key was the Senate, and Trump made that clear, and Q made that clear, after the election, that the target has always been to make sure we get the Senate, because the Senate controls the judiciary, the Senate controls the impeachment, they actually do the actual impeachment, the trial, okay, for impeachment is done in the Senate, and that's not going to go through the Senate. And I truly think, watching what's going on, it is so serious and so severe. I mean, these people are mad. I think there's going to be a landslide across this nation in the 2020 election. I mean, a landslide. And I wouldn't be surprised, and I really seriously mean this, I wouldn't be surprised if Trump didn't win every state, even California.
Honestly, I think... It's gotten so bad. Here's what my concern is. It's so obvious what they're doing is that what is the possibility of them going for a Hail Mary, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. Well, look at they're fighting for their lives. You got to understand. And Q said this: uh-huh. Those who are screaming the loudest have the most to lose here. They're the ones that are the most guilty. So the ones that are screaming the loudest are the ones really. They're talking about themselves. And Trump is ready to turn this whole thing around. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of documents to be laid out, but it's too much to digest. And so the plan is to allow all these conversations to take place, let them acclimate among the people, and then start opening up, the evidence that it's the other direction, all the documentations and everything else that they've got, and the people will be primed for that story. You see, he's allowing them, and he actually tricked them into the narrative. And the narrative they're making against him is going to be the narrative against them. It's really like a perfect plan. It's very interesting. Because if he were to drop this stuff all at one time, the people can't digest this. It's too much. And also the news won't be reporting it. But since they're reporting it already, the narrative will remain the same. It's just the guilty party, will be the opposite side. you know, as Giuliani just said recently, you know, when he was asked, well, one of the news media asked, well, why haven't you brought these things up earlier? And he said, I've been bringing this up since, I think he said, March of this year. April, May, June, I'm not sure anymore. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he said March. It's the beginning of the year. He says, I've been bringing it up, but nobody's running with it. But, you see, now is the time to bring it
up. What about One America News Network?
Stories there. Huh?
What about One America News Network? They're based out in San Diego. They're really, they just started this year.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that. So.
Well, I think they're only internet-based, but their website is really well put together. They're a really good team of people. You can just tell right off the bat.
I don't know if you were in here earlier or one of our other programs we bring up quite often, at least I do anyway, X22 Report. If you go out to YouTube and put an X22 Report, start following that guy and listening to, you know, what he's bringing out. He does a really good story bringing out all of the information behind the scenes, what's really going on, the plans as it's being revealed. He quotes a lot of the stuff as Q drops the drops, and he brings a lot of that stuff into his reporting. And he has sources. You know, he's just not just talking. He's got sources, and he lays that out on his page, you know, underneath the video. So, you know, that's one of the best news sources, in my opinion. But look, things are really going well. It may not look well, but it's going well because, again, the only way to get the narrative out there is to allow them to have the narrative and gear them up to the what needs to be focused in on and then turn the tables on them. Because the people will be listening, and then all of a sudden the tables are turned, and they say, whoa. You know, this is what's really going on. But this is going once the truth comes out, it's going to take a long time before all of this information is out because it's that big and that bad. So, anyway, any final thoughts before we move on to the next person?
Oh, man, it's like that one question just totally stopped everything in my head.
Okay.
Well, I guess not right now, then.
All right, well, thanks for the call. You get back in the queue if we have time, maybe, and we'll see you next week, hopefully. Let me go to our next call. Thanks. Okay, Sean from Arizona, you got the mic.
It's Sean in Arizona.
Yep.
Hey, I've got a you guys went pretty deep there, so the wheels are spinning, but to bring it back home to a personal matter, a quick question on the process once I have an amicus curiae from you. I have it prepared to file. I'll be filing it tomorrow or sending it anyways to file tomorrow after my court today of them entering a motion for summary judgment against me. My question is, what can I do without jeopardizing what we're filing here with the grand jury to stop any proceeding on the judgment against me?
Well, look, at the amicus curiae in law should stop everything in its tracks because the amicus curiae is challenging the jurisdiction of the court. And once jurisdiction is challenged, it must be proven. And that's all in the amicus curiae. And you can bring that up yourself, even if they try to throw that out of the court. And you know what I would do? If I was in the court and an amicus curiae came on my behalf from the grand jury, and I'd make sure I have a couple copies when I went in there. And if the judge says, well, I'm discarding this. They don't have any business. I would, before I go into the court, I would put an X, okay, across the for the grand jury and put my own name in there and have that paper sort of in my back pocket. And then once the judge says, well, we're not accepting that into the record, and then hand it off, well, what about this one? Same words, everything's the same, but it's coming from me. I'm challenging jurisdiction. You don't have jurisdiction. Once jurisdiction is challenged, and again, it says it in there, you can kind of read these things, it must be decided. And it can't be decided by you, because you already believe you got the jurisdiction. It's got to go up the level to another court of record, to the next court of record above, okay, for that decision to be made. So that should buy you time if you can get that going. It may at least put it to a point where they put you off for another month or however often they try to pull you into these kangaroo courts, you know?
Yeah, I've, you know, prior to today, I had filed the challenge of jurisdiction. I had defaulted them on the challenge and made my points. I thought, well, I guess we'll see when the transcript comes, but you know, they just blow past it, and he's
right.
Just you know, not only do I have jurisdiction, but here's the history of the country and how it became to be ratified that this state has the authority to have jurisdiction over you for this statute, and just continuing on with that. So,
well, do you understand the difference between equity and law?
I do,
and civil law.
And I explained it. I think, well, they didn't listen, you know. And I said, hey, look, you know, we're here, and
because
they
don't understand.
Court.
That's the problem, is they don't understand it, okay? And if you understand it, that's a beginning. You know, look at a couple of things when you go into court. You must control the narrative. If you're not controlling the narrative, you're losing, okay? That's number one. Number two, you have to move the court. If the court doesn't move itself when it should, you have to do that. And those are the things, and a lot of that stuff comes with experience, but it's all knowledge to begin with, and then, of course, experience plays a major role in this. Have you got much experience in the court, coming into the court on your own, pro se?
Each time I go in, I have more experience. It's not certainly
well,
not
time
my background.
Well,
each
time you go in, yeah.
But
so you've got to get I go into court, I realize one thing. I always have to fight the judge first. It frustrated the heck out of me because it came to that understanding and realization, and it really, really gnawed at me that I have to go fight the judge before I can defend my case and make my case. It really pissed me off. But, you know, that's what you got to do. And you have to make the judge feel uncomfortable. And doing that, the only way you could do that is kind of saying things that you know he understands but nobody else does, and you're moving things to the court. But it depends on what level of judge you're at. If you're in a town court or a city court or a village court, I mean, those just morons running that. Forget about that. They have no background in
it's
law.
It's a district court.
Anything. Huh?
It's a district court.
I didn't hear that. You're broken up.
It's a district court.
I didn't get. You said something court.
District court. It's a,
oh, district
it's a
court.
Judge in a district court.
Yeah, I don't know what that means per se because every state seems to structure things differently. But if you're in a court of law, which is, if you're in a court of record, a county courts are courts of record, state courts are courts of record. Okay, so those are two courts of record on the state level. Now, a district court, is this a state district court?
Well, he says, yes, it is a state district court. He says that every that all of his courts are courts of record. I asked if it's a court of
law.
He said they're all court of law.
That court's a court of record?
Yes, that's what he told me.
If I was in the courtroom and they said that, then I'd ask them, then why are they not running under the law? Why are you running under civil law? Now, either the judge will understand that or not. You know, you may trip him up with that, and that could be a problem for him too, or her, whereas it'll pull him back and they'll start to be, you know, trying to backstep or try to put the court off for another day until he could figure out how to deal with you, you know. The problem sometimes comes as other people before you have pulled, you know, some of the stuff out of their hat, so to speak, and laid it on the court, and then they learned how to deal with it. But a lot of the stuff they don't know how to deal with. I mean, federal court is the best place to be if you're going to be trying to play chess with the judge, because they understand these things. They understand all of it. They're guilty of sin, okay? They know what Rule 2 is. They know what Rule 12 is. They know that civil law is not the law of the land. They know that there's no power or authority for to change the law by rule. They know that the Constitution is the law of the land. They know that cases before 1950 or whatever year these people say that you know, they don't want any court case brought in that's older than a certain year. I think it's 1950. Someone dropped me a note earlier on that. you know, but when you're in these other courts, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than ignorance and action, and this is what it is, it's ignorance and action. And unless you can trip them up or put the fear of the law into them, you know, it's hard to move past that, and they're just going to keep ruling against you. But again, look, the next step is moving it into federal court for cause. That's where we're heading with it.
Yep.
You just need to bite.
I assume that's what's going to happen, because this knucklehead's going to continue on his path, and it's going to be the same direction.
Yeah.
So I guess it goes back to, what protections should I continue to put out there in the interim as this is being pushed to the joinder and continuing on with your case?
Remember, we can't promise anyone rainbows and lollipops here. At the end of the day, you know, we do believe we're going to get justice. At the end of the day, we do believe we're going to win, okay? I really feel this in my heart and my bones, because I've been at this for a long time. I've been watching this, and we were in impossible situations and positions. We never could have won against these people, and yet look what happens if Trump comes up. And the whole tables have turned. So, you know, that really is giving me a lot of hope and realization of where we're heading to. And I kind of knew this because, you know, I read the Bible, and in Isaiah 14, it seems to be very, very powerfully speaking about what's going on right here these days, ultimately in our courts. And with the New World Order, you know, creating all their evil cities around the world. The Bible talks about that. And he's, you know, God says, I'm not going to let you. You're not going to create your evil cities throughout the world. And he's going to take them down. So that tells me that judgment is going to come to nations. And I think that's where we're at. So, I mean, I could be wrong on that, but that's how I read it. And so it kind of, you know, helps to fortify that also. But, you know, you may not win right away, and they continue to plow you down. We're doing the best we can, but at the end of the day, I do believe everything's going to turn around and you'll get justice. Because remember, no matter what the ruling or no matter what it takes place, once there is fraud on the court, once you're in a jurisdiction unknown that you don't belong in, everything has to be turned back, you know, rewound, okay? And it doesn't matter when you discover that. You could have been arrested, tried, convicted, went to jail for 5 years, got out, and 3 years later or whatever, put whatever days and years you want there, and then all of a sudden discover that you were in a jurisdiction had nothing to do with you and that there was fraud on the court. And you can go in, and if you can get into a court of law, you will win, and everything will be turned back. Okay, everything will be turned back, and you'd be restored. Of course, you've suffered, and you'll never get the full suffering, you know, paid to you of what you suffered. But at least you'll get justice, and things will turn back. But you know, people who have more time, they have more of a possibility of succeeding before their court case is over. But some people, their court case may get over with, and they may have bad results. But at some point in time, I do believe that as long as you're persistent and you continue to press towards the mark, that all this can be overturned at some point, and you'll get justice. Because I think justice is coming to America. Remember, here's what drives me. Okay. You know, here's the bottom line, for me anyway, okay? What are we doing here? We're fighting to restore the king back to his court. And of course, the king could get back in his court any time, but he uses people to do everything. So, but that's what our mission is, to get the king back into the court. Who's the king? Well, nature's God is the king. So we want to bring him back. We made a covenant with him in the Declaration of Independence. We covenant with God. And in return for living under his law and his justice, we no longer have to live under man's law, although we've been brought back under that, but that's another story. But nevertheless, from coming under his law, his blessings for our desire to be under that is liberty. And that's where our liberty comes from, unalienable. And the Bill of Rights is just the tip of that iceberg. And so, you know, they're fighting against God is what they're doing. And so that's the key thing. We're trying to get the king back into the court. The king's going to get back into the court, and we're going to win, and that's that.
I'm all for helping anywhere and everywhere I can, and particularly with regard to how to make it a better place for our kids and grandkids. And I just had to bring the king back into the court. I guess so. This one's over. As it stands, I'll be sending the amicus curiae back, filing it. I don't want to jeopardize that or do anything to interrupt it. I know I don't want to do any filing.
No, anything you do is not going to hurt that, because your battle is going to be the same as the amicus curiae anyway. They don't have jurisdiction over you. You're not getting due process. You're not in a proper court of record. You can call it a court of record, but it's not a court of record. A court of record proceeds according to the common law. That's natural law. What are these statutes doing in here, Judge? If you say this is a court of record, why am I being held under statutes? Why am I, you know, being assaulted by these statutes? What do they have to do with me? These are things that belong in equity courts, and you call this a civil court, and a civil court is operating under Rule 2 of the federal jurisdiction, you know, the federal rules of procedures, and not only court procedure, but the procedures of evidence. And under Rule 2, it makes the claim that it has fused together water and oil that cannot be fused together. They fused together law and equity, and came up with civil law, civil action called civil law. How do you get that? This isn't even a court of equity. This is a jurisdiction unknown. I have no clue what jurisdiction this is. By the way, where is your jurisdiction? State it for me, please. Because it has to be written somewhere. Where is it written? Where is your jurisdiction? And they'll say stupid things, because this is how dumb they are. They'll say a court of record is a court that keeps a record. I mean, that's the morons we're dealing with. That's how bad and defunct these people are, to think that, I mean, that does seem at first glance that's what it might mean. But how about looking it up if you're a lawyer or a judge? How about looking that up and understanding what a court of record is? It's a court that proceeds according to the common law, under the rules of common law. And the rules of common law, you know, basically, you know, is truth. I mean, that is really the rules of common law. You know, it's maxims. You know, truth that's so obvious. And so the court of law is governed by the rules of common law, which is maxims. And there are some books, and we have them up online, of maxims by a couple of different individuals who have written the things on maxims and listed out different maxims that could be used in the court. And we already used some of them, and we've used them. You know, everybody knows that you're innocent until proven guilty. That's a maxim. That's what that is. That comes from common law. It's a maxim. For every injury, there must be a remedy. Okay, well, that's a maxim. You can't argue with that. All men are created equal. You cannot argue with that. You see, that's truth. That's what governs a natural law court. That's the rules of the court. Okay, they have written rules. Okay. And of course they're written to control equity courts, but now they've controlled civil law courts, which is Babylon. You're in a Babylonian court. And you know what? I've talked to lawyers, and they've admitted that their courts are under the same rulings as Roman law. Okay, that's pretty scary when a lawyer says that it's Roman law.
Well, anyone can do a little bit of homework and see that, you know, if you're looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars and you're being denied the king's bench of 12 untainted, that it's Roman law. So,
yeah.
Well, here we
yeah.
are. And
all right, well, look, we've come to the end of our time.
Yeah, I don't want to find anything, like I said, that's contradictory, and I don't want to just leave it hanging out there for them to come.
You can fight any way you want. There's nothing wrong with that. It won't lose your position. Remember, the position's coming in on ultimately on law from the, you know, the grand jury and the amicus curiae. And again, you could bring up those points. You know, look, I'm challenging jurisdiction. Jurisdiction, once challenged, must be decided, and it can't be decided by you, Your Honor. Let's go to the next court of record above here. And it's up to the court to make that move, but they won't. And that's where you got to make the move. But you're making the move with the amicus curiae because that's the next step, is to move it to federal court because.
Right. And a filing of a void judgment is not going to interfere with that while we're doing
that. Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Okay.
No.
Perfect.
Defend yourself
hey,
every way you
God.
Can. Okay, you too. Thanks. Okay. It's 15 minutes after the hour now. We're 15 minutes over, so we're going to shut down. I know we've got a few people in the queue, but it's time to go. Try to get in early in the queue next week, and we'll catch you early. Anyway, with that, good night. Lord willing, we'll see you all next Monday. And again, everybody should read these papers we've been filing. They should be in the course, getting educated. They should consider becoming an administrator if they're open for a new job. For administrator for the juries, and everyone, even those in the jury, administrators can do this also, but everyone should run for committee man this coming year up. Let's take back the political process. We'll be teaching that starting probably next month, not October, but November, but we may start in the later part of October. We will be covering some of that in a new video that we're going to be posting up on our website, which will be on the front page, which we might name National Liberty Alliance or NLA's plan in a nutshell, but something like that. Not sure what we're going to call it yet, but something like that. And it's going to cover a good chunk of, to give you a good piece of understanding, a good chunk concerning, you know, becoming a committee man, how the process works, and the power and the authorities of the committee man, and how we can use that to turn this whole thing on their all these people up on their heads, to turn everything back right side up again. Let's put it that way. So, okay, thanks everyone. Good night.